Okay, good morning, everyone. We need to go ahead and get started. Our agenda this morning is fairly packed, and we're aware that lots of you have 5:30, whatever flights, and we'll probably be leaving, you know, 3-ish. We've planned for that. That's a very normal thing. So if you feel that's your circumstance, you're not alone. So we do want to get started. We've put up a slide of the summary of what you did yesterday. Of the 15 measures reviewed, you rated 9 of them as meeting the criteria for endorsement. So with that, we have another day of measure evaluation. And so, Laura, Carol, whoever.
All righty. So first on the agenda will be Jennifer to do incidents of episiotomy. And do we know if there's someone from Christiana here?
Matt, you're here from Christiana, right?
Oh, okay.
And did we get the handheld mic for you?
If not, you might want to sit right
got
here on the
side
next to the mic.
This is incidence of episiotomy. Just to orient everybody, clinically, episiotomy is one of the
clinically to what episiotomy is, to make sure we're all on the same page. Episiotomy is when the doctor cuts the perineum right before delivery, thought to facilitate delivery in some schools, can also be used in an emergency situation to try to hasten delivery. The evidence against using it is fairly significant in that it increases the chance of third and fourth degree tears through the rectal sphincter or rectal mucosa, which are, needless to say, painful and can lead to incontinence of flatus and stool later in a woman's life. So that's sort of the scientific background to this measure. This measure is calculated off of administrative data, and it is measured only in women who have a vaginal delivery. It is the procedure incidence in women having vaginal delivery over all vaginal deliveries. The one exclusion is shoulder dystocia, generally considered an emergency and would be an appropriate time to use an emergency procedure, like an episiotomy. In terms of what the work group thought at our conference call, the importance of measure was 5 high and 4 moderate. Opportunities for improvement are quite high, with 6 high and 3 moderate. The evidence shows that there's a wide variety of rates in hospitals. I don't have those numbers right in front of me, but it was a 10 or 20 point spread between hospitals. And we also agreed, with one exception, that it meets importance. So with that, why don't we open up to the discussion of importance to measure
any comments or questions? If not, we should vote. Screens over here. Everybody's trying to get oriented. The screens over here, this is going to be a yes, no. This is yesterday.
Can't see when it opens up, though. No. Can you scoot over to Matt's other side, maybe? There you go. Okay, so that was pretty clear cut. Move on to scientific. So this is reliability and validity. In terms of measuring, this is a procedure coded in CPT codes, and generally charged pretty well. Procedures in general are coded well. Unlike other kinds of surgeries, though, global care charging in pregnancy means that it can't be charged for specifically, but we still, I think that the general consensus is that that coding is pretty reliable. There's been some work on whether the medical record as the gold standard meets with the coding. That work is quoted in this document, and it shows there's a pretty high fidelity, and that when there isn't fidelity, it's equally divided between undercoding and overcoding. So just a random variation as opposed to systematic error.
Is with the coding issues, is it under and overcoding the degree of the episiotomy, or is it with the quote laceration versus intentional?
So my understanding is because this is not an outcome, we're not looking at the degree. It's not the diagnosis of degree, but it's actually the procedure. It's yes or no. It's a. So those thoughts or questions?
Jennifer, is that captured as well in electronic coding?
So this study, my understanding is that the electronic coding or the administrative billing data, which is what this is built off of, and that's the study of the electronic data. There's fidelity there, with the exception of the few hospitals that don't, the few codes that aren't don't have high fidelity are equally distributed among over and undercoded. And if you want, I can try to find that number. I don't know if anybody else can find the line and verse faster than I can, but Matt, do you remember off the top of your head?
So our validation study was done against NSAPE. We chose a cohort of hospitals and looked at two separate ethics. So again, we do use UB92 billing information and compared it against the medical record we had for the subset of patients, but with and without physiotomy be compared.
Matt, could you turn your mic on?
Enough. Just to repeat myself, so the validation study that we did involved NPIC. We used a cohort of the larger C-Rich hospital, which is an entity underneath NPIC. It is predicated upon billing data per se, but then we compared it to the medical record. We looked at two separate epics and basically found very good consistency between the medical record and the coding data in the majority of hospitals. Where there was miscoding, it was a relatively small percentage. And once again, as Jen had mentioned, was equally divided pretty much between those who undercoded and overcoded.
Other thoughts or concerns that you want to raise?
Question. Is coding, does coding affect billing in this case? Because in general, the principle uses codes and claims data are more reliable if they're related to billing and audited.
Mike's not on.
There is some individuation within insurance plans, but for the majority of times it's captured underneath global codes. The other part, if it's recorded in the medical record, is generally coders, hospital-based coders, who are choosing to do this, and then generally they're fairly professional in their behavior.
So global meaning that there's one charge no matter what you do during the delivery.
Right.
I can speak to this a little bit in my institution because at the Cleveland Clinic we started tracking this a few years back. And we found that there was a lot of documentation issue. Many times this got documented in the nurse record rather than the provider record. So now that providers know it's being tracked, they're taking responsibility for documenting more correctly. So that may help.
Questions? I know that, Matt, on this submission for maintenance, this measure was previously endorsed 3 years ago. The level of analysis is just facility. And I know 3 years ago the discussion was including clinician level as a level of analysis. I'm wondering, was that deliberately excluded or because that is a change?
So from our perspective, we think the starting at the level of facility is more appropriate and will cause general change rather than necessarily targeting providers. I will say that I also participate on the AMA PCPI and they are looking at it as an individual measure, so that may be forthcoming.
So, frankly, NQF's preference is to use a single measure with
broadest applicability rather than multiple little measures, as you'll see in our discussion of related and competing measures later today.
And just as a researcher comment, I mean, I think the confidence intervals around the individual providers are so not reliable that I'm not sure you could even look at it for any given provider. They're doing maybe handfuls. They're doing more than handfuls. That's concerning, but then they have to have a lot of deliveries. So really the hospital level is a more stable number to look at, I think.
Any further questions, or can we vote on scientific acceptability of the measure? Yes, 0 no.
So is this understandable by the public? I think yes, and a lot of women going into labor understand what a cut is. Most of them don't want it. Just the ick factor is publicly understandable. And then is this meaningfully understandable and useful for quality improvement? I think so. I think there's fairly good consensus in the literature that this is not a desirable thing. It should be used sparingly. And there's wide variation and performance gap, which would lead to the potential for quality improvement.
Yes, my question just would be, within the last 3 years, you know, do you have evidence or data that people have used this to affect improvement since it's been out there for a while now? So can we see some benefit of its use?
So I can share with Lisa, within my own institution, we've gone from a 16% rate to a 4% rate. So by simply tracking and reporting, when we do it on a physician level, because we have the ability of offer of our EMR to do that, we've been able to decrease our rate substantially. I think California has had a like experience. I can let Elliot comment to that. But I know that it is being tracked in other institutions and have shown improvements.
Matt, I'm just curious, because this tends to be a sort of, and I may get myself in trouble here, but a procedure used by older providers that used to be much more popular. As those folks are retiring, do we have any evidence that it's actually the measurement as opposed to just the natural attrition of that generation of OBs?
Well, so she just threw me under the bus. I mean, I was trained to always do an episiotomy. You would much rather do an episiotomy than let the pelvis shatter. I'm still not convinced not doing an episiotomy is the right thing, but I don't do episiotomies anymore. But it's a big culture change. It's a big practice change for many of the physicians, not just the older ones, but many of the younger ones as well. And we have been tracking this on an individual basis in our hospital. It's had dramatic effects. So from a quality standpoint, it has been very powerful. We dropped our rate. Well, ACOG's rate, I think 2006 was 33%. It's gone down and down and down. As a system with 22,000 deliveries, we were at about 18 or 19%. Now we're under 10% and going down. So there's a lot of change here, but I think it's a very powerful measure for quality improvement.
I'm curious, with your decrease in episiotomies, have you seen an increase in your tears?
So what one does see is a slight increase in anterior compartment tears, so labial tears as a trade-off. Those are usually minor, usually don't require stitching, fairly benign issues compared to the other of third and fourth degrees.
Anybody else?
Other questions? We vote on.
I guess yes. So this is a question for the OBs. Like, where's the trade-off line between, you know, the so one catastrophic tear to, you know, maybe like the episiotomies. So I don't, you know, like, what does it mean for an individual mom to have a grade 4 tear and incontinence as opposed to many moms having an episiotomy? Like, how do we make that cut off? You know, we can make the episiotomy rates go down, but, you know, how do we make that? Like, maybe you can help us think about this. So
So let me clarify. So the issue is by cutting an episiotomy, you in fact weaken that tissue, predisposing a woman to a third and fourth degree. So if you will, an episiotomy is on the pathway to raising the incidence of third and fourth degree tears. So in fact, it's a preventive measure against third and fourth degree lacerations.
So yeah, lowering the episiotomy rate should lower the fourth and third degree tear rate.
And that's been actually shown. There's an article in a French hospital where they instituted a policy, and they demonstrated as they lowered their episiotomy rate, their third and fourth grade incidence went down.
Just anecdotally, at our hospital, we almost never cut them, and we are actually having trouble with our residents because they don't know how to repair a fourth degree anymore. They just don't see them anymore. I don't want to throw my residents under the bus either, but it becomes a, you know, the senior resident case now as opposed to what used to be a lower level case.
I guess I understand that, but I've also seen third and fourth degrees occur because episiotomy was not done.
So I think the argument has been made initially, is an episiotomy easier to repair than a third and fourth degree that spontaneously develops? Yet if you look at it, episiotomy clearly leads to more third and fourth across the incidence. So what you see is it's going to occur predicated upon factors that remain beyond the obstetrician's control, the size of the baby, the size of the mother. There are actually ethnic differences as well. So no, we're not going to eliminate third and fourth degrees, but we will minimize them. And the one factor that is underneath the obstetrician's control is the decision to cut an episiotomy.
And wouldn't there be a way for NPIC to track this more systematically, or like across multiple institutions?
So in fact, in our submission, we did do that and demonstrated that in fact what we see is wide variation within hospitals. So one of our hospitals had a 33% rate, another one had, I believe it was a less than 10% rate. So there is tremendous variation. In earlier answer to the earlier question, we are seeing a decrease with time as we're seeing a cultural change, yet it still remains a significant percentage of women, in particular hospitals, that are having high rates of episiotomy. As attention has been focused on it, we're seeing decreases in the overall rates, and we're thinking that's leading to improved outcomes.
So can we go ahead and vote on usability for this measure? Remember here we're doing high, moderate, low.
Can I just clarify? So someone said you didn't expect it to be used in public reporting, but really we're voting on whether it is suitable for public reporting across hospitals,
yeah,
right?
I never, at least if you're referring to me, it wasn't at hospital level. It was physician level. I'm not sure it's ready for prime time. To the hospital level, absolutely, in my mind at least.
Oh, Kim doesn't have a... Oh, you do? Oh, okay. Can everybody press it one more time just so that we don't get the... Okay. All right, so moving on.
Yeah, this is just a request. Could I ask that we use more inclusive language, acknowledging the fact that not all births are attended by physicians? Many of them are attended by nurse midwives.
Mm-hmm. The next slide up?
Yeah, the next.
Yep. So in terms of feasibility, these are data generated during care. It's routine administrative data. It is electronically coded. And we talked a little bit before about the fidelity of the coding compared to the medical record. So I think as Matt and his group has shown, that this data is fairly easy to use and manipulate across a wide group of hospitals and able to make comparisons.
Okay. we vote on feasibility?
$15 high, $5 moderate, $0 low. I don't know if anybody's on the line or not.
And moving on. So overall suitability for endorsement for this measure? So 19 yes, 1 no. Thank you. So our next measure is exclusive breastfeeding at hospital discharge.
I have that one.
Yeah. Can I just say a couple few words? The next measures we're going to be introducing are from the Joint Commission. These four measures were endorsed during NQF's previous work, and they had different measure developers. Since that time, the Joint Commission has partnered with those original measure developers to bring these measures forward under their steward, sort of under the stewardship of the Joint Commission. All right. So they're expected to, you know, they've made this a little bit of evolution and transition.
Okay, great. So this is exclusive breastfeeding during hospitalization. It's for singleton term infants. I think, unlike episiotomy, it's pretty self-evident what exclusive breastfeeding is. You know, multiple recommendations from multiple medical professional societies and Department of Health and Human Services and the Healthy People 2010 and 2020 goals. Lots of medical benefits for the baby and the mom that have been described, and significant gaps in performance relative to the Healthy People 2010 goals. For exclusive breastfeeding at discharge, the goal is 75%. Data from the Joint Commission, looking at four quarters of data reported in 2011, have a rate at 41.5%, so a little more than half of where we're supposed to be. The idea of exclusive breastfeeding at discharge is that it increases the likelihood of continued breastfeeding at 3 months and 6 months. Some data presented that for women who exclusively breastfeed at discharge from the hospital, they are 7 times more likely to be breastfeeding at 1 month compared to women who have some level of breastfeeding, but it's not exclusive at discharge from the hospital. There's also data presented on disparities by race and ethnicity. So from a importance point of view, you know, it's our group thought obviously it was very high. Both the quantity, quality, and consistency of the data is high. Questions or comments?
I guess my concern with this one is that it's very susceptible to who your patients are as opposed to what the doctor is doing. And I know that we talk about racial disparities. We don't want to excuse those. We don't want to excuse the economic disparities that exist. But that, to a large degree, those are outside of the physician's purview and ability to change. If you've got a 15-year-old mom with no breastfeeding support at home, you can maybe convince her to do some things in the hospital, but that chance of actually having it go forward is little. My other concern is that the hospitals who are trying so hard to do this go in the other direction of patient autonomy, so that they're forcing people to breastfeed who don't want to rest, or, you know, moms who are quite sick who really just need to rest are being forced to breastfeed as well. So there's a trade-off here, and I just want to make sure that we're not incentivizing people to go in the other direction.
Yeah, I think we're a little bit talking about apples and oranges because, first of all, it's much more than the provider who has an impact on whether the mother goes home exclusively breastfeeding. A lot of this has to do with nursing care. And if we don't acknowledge the fact that it's the whole system, that's what Baby-Friendly Hospital Initiative is all about, creating that environment
that truly supports breastfeeding from the get-go. One of my concerns about this measure is it's unrelated to intention. The mother who comes in intending to breastfeed is not in the equation anywhere. Perhaps that might be another measure that we could talk about, but I really believe, and I think there's ample data to support, that if the environment supports the mother who intends to breastfeed, she will be successful. And I really highly endorse this measure and want us to think beyond. It's not about the provider. It's the whole environment of the hospital or the birthing, the side birthing of whether or not the mother goes home exclusively breastfeeding.
I would agree with that. I guess my concern still is that's true for the mother who intends to breastfeed. For the mother who's dead set against it,
that's not what this measure is about. It's about who goes home exclusively breastfeeding.
Right, but for the mother who doesn't want to breastfeed, who the hospital's going to measure on the quality, and that mother's going to be a ding, she gets tremendous pressure to breastfeed.
I would say there's other evidence from the nursing literature that if even mothers who we consider high risk, who we consider unlikely to breastfeed, if they're appropriately taught and brought to understand the benefits of breastfeeding, any mother, regardless of situation, wants to do the best thing for her baby. And I've helped plenty of young mothers breastfeed very successfully. I've helped plenty of disadvantaged mothers. And I think there's evidence in the nursing literature, particularly from Paula Meyer and Rush University, that shows that supporting, even in the NICU, supporting very disadvantaged mothers to breastfeed can be highly successful. And often what they will say is nobody told me how important it was for my baby that I breastfeed.
I guess in my last sort of rebuttal, it would be that we're seeing a tripling of our methadone moms and our moms with polypharmacy, and our pediatricians don't want those moms breastfeeding for, I think, good reasons, and there's no exclusion for that kind of thing. So, you know, depending on your hospital, that's very different than a private community suburban hospital when you have a lot of methadone moms and a lot of poly drug use. So I just think we need to build some of those medical exceptions or at least an acknowledgement of some of the extenuating circumstances into this.
Louisiana has, we're 50th in the nation in breastfeeding. We have tremendous disparities. Our African-American women initiate at much, much lower rates. We're talking 20%, 30% in some settings. So let me just start by saying this measure, I think, is fine. But it sets the bar extremely high. And so my comments later today when we talk about new measures, we need new measures for breastfeeding. I think this is, you know, if you're in a setting where breastfeeding rates are high, exclusive breastfeeding is fine to look at. In Louisiana, our rates are practically zero of this rate. You look at circumcision, is it, and some, there's some concern at Women's Hospital, which is our largest birthing hospital, if you give sugar water. Is that, then does that mean you didn't exclusively breastfeed? So there's confusion about the measure. It's very difficult to measure because you have to, it's every single episode of care and feeding of that infant in the hospital is being exclusive, rather than looking at what we're thinking about putting on our report card is breastfeeding at discharge, because at least you're then just looking at one day of data instead of the entire hospital stay. And discharge, if you're breastfeeding that day, that's a good indication that you're intending to breastfeed at home. Another thing, I just looked at our PRAMS data, our population-based data of pregnant women, about disparities in hospital experience. Once women intend to breastfeed, we found that African-American women had much less hospital support even once they had initiated. So they were more likely to get a gift bag. They were less likely to get numbers in counseling and lactation consultant referrals in hospitals than white women, even though they had both wanted to breastfeed. So I think there are issues associated with disparities here that need to be looked at in metrics. But my issue with this measure particularly is that it's so labor-intensive to collect it. Hospitals complain a lot about it because it's every single episode of feeding. And we're not looking at disparities. And we ought to maybe look, if we want to do improvement, we ought to look at something that we can improve easier since we're so lagging. States that really need help, we ought to be looking at a lower mark, maybe breastfeeding at discharge. Maybe we could talk about that more later.
Yeah, the question there actually, it didn't come up in our discussion group, but for hospitals that are reporting on this, are they looking at every episode of breastfeeding, whether that's exclusive, or is it intention, an early note in the chart of intention to exclusively breastfeed?
In Louisiana, Women's Reports this measure is every single episode.
time-consuming. It's a lot of work.
I mean, just to echo what Jennifer was saying, in our area, we've had some mothers complain to the hospital or even change hospitals to deliver the babies because they had no intention of breastfeeding. Perhaps they tried it last time. It was unsuccessful. And they were so belittled and intimidated by our nursing staff that was so focused on this measure to be baby friendly that they did not want to come back. And so we're actually having some of our patients that felt that way come to our baby friendly committee next month and talk about their experiences. So I think there can be too much emphasis on the ones that don't want to breastfeed for one reason or another.
I'm sorry, did you want to go?
Kathleen, please.
Well, I just wanted to say that this measure has been very helpful at our hospital. We are a large community hospital, so not like what you have. We're more like women's hospital, I guess. But our pediatricians were routinely ordering sugar water after every birth, supplementation in the hospital. And when this came out, this was extremely helpful. It changed practice right away. And, yes, it is labor-intensive, but it's been very positive. We were able to get more lactation consultants on staff because of it. We were able to change those quirky practices that had not been able to be changed for evidence, but they were changed by now we were looking at this, and it's been very helpful. We do measure every feeding to make sure that the baby didn't get any sugar water or supplementation, so it does take a lot of time, but it's been very positive.
Hi. In New Jersey, we actually do risk adjust for breastfeeding. We've been reporting breastfeeding at discharge for, 15 years to our hospitals, and they weren't really paying much attention because they would always argue that our, populations differ between hospitals serving Newark and hospitals serving Princeton, and there was just never going to be any kind of, dialogue on that level. So we started doing risk adjustment. We also, started bringing out evidence, which was, CDC did a great job. The developers, by the way, did a great job summarizing the whole literature on what is the hospital's piece of all of this, and that awareness has only come around in the last 4 or 5 years, that you have documentation that providers will pay attention to that say, there's a hospital piece. PRAMS, we've used PRAMS to actually demonstrate that women who start breastfeeding but then are not exclusively breastfed during the duration of hospital stay have different outcomes post, 8 weeks postpartum. So, the face validity of this with providers is tough if there isn't some kind of an acknowledgement that some moms are different. Our risk adjustment is basically on the basis of race and educational attainment, and that's all. So it's easy to do, but if you don't want to do it, you could stratify by education and race group, and maybe that, so that's something at least at a minimum to recommend sort of stratifying. So to increase the usability of this with the population you most need to talk to, which is the, one of the populations, which is the provider population. Oh, by the way, we did a study that said that about 40% of the variance in hospital-to-hospital breastfeeding rates came out via the risk adjustment model. So it's not at all insignificant, although it isn't the whole story, and that's the whole point, is that it's got two pieces.
In terms of Jennifer's last comment about the provider not willing to do this, one of the denominator exclusions is documented reason for not exclusively breastfeeding. So if there is a documented reason, then...
Depending on where you are, though, that gets, HIV count, does methadone count, does methadone plus cocaine count? I mean, it gets, how you parse that gets tricky.
Yeah, so it sort of moves us to the next area of scientific acceptability. So the exclusions are,
are we done with importance? Like, is everybody on board here? Because maybe we should vote on this and then move to the next thing.
Absolutely. Feel free.
What we've learned is there's no such thing as an easy measure here. No matter what you do, there are all kinds of what, even something as simple as breastfeeding gets very complicated when you try to turn it into a measure. I think there's a couple of key points here. First is the disparity issue was a big issue in California because it's a huge state with a lot of different ethnic groups, and this is an issue that we've been working on for 5 or 6 years in California, and have shown that actually if you put a whole community at work, you can actually change ethnic acceptance of breastfeeding quite successfully. We have some counties that have taken this on through their MCH programs very aggressively. A lot of public outreach and have markedly increased the breastfeeding, the exclusive breastfeeding rates in hospitals in Southern California where the rates are much lower. Also, there are hospitals that serve minority groups in different parts of the state that do much better than other parts of the state. In Oakland, for example, which is a very high African-American population, they have very good breastfeeding rates, whereas other hospitals in other parts of the states don't do as well. So there are opportunities to overcome the ethnic differences, but we're not looking for 100%. I mean, that's really the whole take-home thing. And it gets to the point of overzealous nurses. There has to be some sensitivity training that we're not looking for every mom to do exclusive breastfeeding for the whole day. We're looking for, you know, a reasonable number, and if the mother is not interested, that should be very acceptable. But that's a slippery slope if you start putting that into the measure definition, though. And again, if you accept less than 100%, that should come out. There are a lot of documented reasons that would exclude you from breastfeeding, including methadone, including HIV. Those are all on the Joint Commission list now. So that those end up not being a big number, though, in most hospitals. You know, maybe Jen at Metro, it's a little higher number, but in most hospitals, it's still 5-10% at the most. There are ways of doing the documentation that make it less onerous to collect. Maybe you want to talk about that.
Actually, we're out doing reliability visits right now on this measure, and depending on how you have your chart set up, if you go to the feeding record, you can get all of this data, and most newborns that are healthy aren't going to be in the hospital more than a couple of days. So in my experience, at probably 7 or 8 different hospitals, it's probably been less than 5 minutes per record to take a look at that information. If they're admitted to a NICU, they're immediately excluded, so you don't look further in the record. And then you strictly look at the feeding records. If they've had strictly formula, then you would have to look further to see if there was an indicated reason that's acceptable in our exclusions. But if they're a combination, that tells me that there wasn't a reason. You wouldn't start breastfeeding if there was a maternal reason to exclude. So it really hasn't been too difficult to find this information in the records.
We looked for a number of years trying to compare how women who exclusively breastfed versus women who breast and bottle fed, combined feeding. And it was sort of interesting. Most hospitals claimed extraordinarily high rates of breast and bottle, 90+%. But where you saw the biggest discrimination between rates, or the biggest variance between rates, was in the rates of exclusive breastfeeding. And that's what's been associated in a number of pediatric studies with long-term success of breastfeeding at the 3 and 6 month mark, which is really what we're doing as a surrogate for 3 and 6 month breastfeeding, because that's almost impossible to collect with current data collection systems. We didn't feel that combined breastfeeding was a reasonable target that would show value, because it could be, you know, just the baby at a breast briefly and mostly bottle feeding would qualify under that. And so we really wanted to shift toward exclusive, knowing that it would not be 100%. Though we have hospitals in California right now are ranging from 40 to about 85-90%. And that's actually up about 20% from where it was a few years ago, both on the low end and the high end.
Our health plans serve exclusively vulnerable populations, and I just think that this measure is hugely important to those populations. And ensure safety net hospitals may not score as well on this measure as other, you know, community hospitals in nice suburbs. Having said that, Medicaid health plans are measured prenatal, postnatal visits, just as commercial plans are, and we don't score as well either. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't measure the measure.
Have you thought about stratifying for race? Come over here. Because I just think in this measure, I mean, I'm just really cautious about how we think about disparities. And, you know, you don't want to set different goals or benchmarks, but it might be informative to hospitals to see that some people are doing very well, some hospital systems are doing well with some populations, and they may not be able to make that direct comparison without stratified results.
The issue of race is very difficult as far as defining it as a reliable data element, and that's been the problem. If it was strictly you had two African Americans, well, the baby would be African American, but what if the mom's half African American, half Hispanic, the father is Chinese? I'm just throwing that out there. What race, seriously, and that's been the problem where we'd like to be able to do that, but until we can find a reliable way of measuring race, it's almost impossible to do that in a reliable manner where it would be meaningful.
Yeah.
Right. I really think that particular argument ought to go away. I live in the District of Columbia, and we used to have arguments about whether a baby was Hispanic or African American. You know, we've now got rules, and I think most everybody building measures follows them. We haven't talked at all about the benefit to the child of the breastfeeding, and this happens to be a measure that the national partnership and I personally am very supportive of. As a working mom, many years ago, my OB suggested that I try breastfeeding for a month because 4 weeks was all I had of leave. Of course, once you've done it for a month, it's so easy, you just keep going. And so in fact, it was very, very helpful. And we really hope that this will continue to be in the measure set.
I think what you said there was really interesting, and it strikes me that it's almost like a social policy issue that we're attacking at the wrong end. You know, so we're measuring the providers for something that employers aren't allowing, you know, mother's time for. Let's put that out there.
That's actually one of the goals that the partnership hopes to work on, that workplace friendly for the nursing mom.
And I would just echo that. I think this is a great population health measure. I just don't think this is a great health system measure. I'm very intrigued by the fact that you said you can raise it in the community. If we wanted to collect this at hospitals and report it at the community level, that'd be great, because then you're really bringing in to play the bigger support system that's not just the hospital.
I think what we found, though, is that there's a huge amount of impact that the nurses and the physicians have in hospitals on the mother's actual follow-through in activity on this area. So it's really about systems change, both systems in the communities as well as systems in the hospital and the obstetric and pediatric community. Yes, it needs some longer-term change in the employment, but this is really focused on the parts that we can control in the healthcare system.
I would just echo that because of this measure, hospitals are now putting into place lactation support, and it's trickling down. You don't need just a lactation specialist. All the nurses are now being trained. Where the big fallout is in the middle of the night. That's when you need the most support. And I have to say that this is one time where it's not the providers, but it's the doctors that needed to be educated, because even though we know it's a good thing, you know, the doctors, the obstetricians were saying, oh, no, she needs her rest. And so it really took, you know, looking at the evidence and bringing it forward, and our pediatricians nagging the obstetricians to really help make this system change. And I actually think sometimes the education was a detriment, that, you know, that the more educated you are, the less you thought it was a big deal. And so bringing this evidence out and sharing it with everyone actually led to some pretty significant system changes.
I would also comment that some of the healthcare reform legislation that's been enacted provides access to lactation consultants and breast pumps, which will help women, working women particularly, continue longer term. So some of the system changes are sort of moving in the direction of supporting this more for more women.
Just with the race debate that we've had before, and I'd appreciate our colleagues from California's input on that. We noticed that some of our Asian population, they end up breastfeeding at home, but for cultural reasons, they do not want to do it in the hospital. even when we talk to them, support them, say, like, you know, we really would support you doing it. They just don't want to do it in the hospital, but they'll breastfeed the students there at home. But I don't know if you have any experience with that with a larger patient population in California.
My hospital delivers 6,000 babies a year, of which 40% are Asian. It's probably the largest Asian delivery service in the country. That is a population that has less exclusive breastfeeding in general, but our hospital as a whole still has 75% overall exclusive breastfeeding during hospital stay. So it's it's a matter of communication and working with the community ahead of time. And you're looking for shifts over time. There are certainly ethnic variations to start with. California does report this, both your hospital is total exclusive, and we do break it down by race using birth certificate race categories. So that is a reasonable thing.
And the data in this report suggests that for Asian women who are exclusively breastfeeding at discharge, about 59% of those are breastfeeding at 1 month versus only 20% who leave the hospital not exclusively breastfeeding.
Several quick comments. To Lee's comment about benefits for the baby, I'd like to say this is a great measure for moms as well, so I think that's very valuable. I'd like to echo the sentiment that the fact of the disparities means that we could really benefit from really strong measures. And finally, I want to mention the MPINC survey from CDC, which shows phenomenal variation in hospital practice and around practices around breastfeeding and tremendous opportunities for improvement.
Okay, so I think we should move on. Can we vote on importance to measure and report for this measure? Can you put your phone on mute, please, if you're on the line? Thank you.
Yes,
that's it.
21 yes, 3 no.
Okay, so let's move on. Okay, so scientific acceptability, we discussed some of these already. Just the exclusions in the measure are multiple births, babies admitted to the NICU, an experience of death, a baby enrolled in a clinical trial, or a mother enrolled in a clinical trial, wants to stay greater than 120 days, transferred to another hospital, infants on TPN, and documented reasons to not exclusively breastfeed, which are specified in the measure. They include HIV, illicit drug use, mother taking other drugs, chemotherapy agents, et cetera, TB, active breast herpes. That's really it. This question about whether there are other sort of reasons to breastfeed that are being gamed in the chart, I think, Jennifer, you sort of suggested maybe that's going on. There's not really a discussion about that.
So I have two questions. One is general, because it comes up in a number of different submissions, and then the other is more specific, I think. First, reliability testing. You mentioned that you're going to be doing that, you know, this year, and I'm just wondering in general how long it takes to do reliability testing, because I noticed on a couple of these measures that were approved in 2008 that were about to do reliability testing. What's the sort of time span on that? And I noticed this in a couple of different measures that we're reviewing today.
We're actually doing reliability site visits on all five of our measures in the measure set. And we started in October and we'll be finished in January as far as the site visits. Our statisticians selected 12 sites randomly across the country and we're re-extracting approximately 30 medical records per site. So
let me restate my question. So for a measure that's approved in October of 2008, now I assume because the package wasn't implemented until 2010, I mean, I'm making some assumptions. I'm just trying to figure out what's the... It just seems like I wish we had the data now is what I'm asking.
You do. So the report says that at least in four quarters that they looked at that the rate of exclusive hospital breastfeeding changed from 39.7% to 42.9%.
So some change in here.
It was a matter, it took time once they were endorsed for us to actually specify them, to get our manual out, to give everybody 6 months to embed the measures. Our performance measurement systems vendors who act as our intermediary between the hospital and the Joint Commission, we had to review all of their data collection tools to make sure that they were valid and reliable. So there's a period of time, kind of a setup time, and then actually after we received the first couple of quarters of data, we determined that there were additional enhancements that were needed to the measure specifications. So we're actually doing reliability visits on our second version of the manual. It's not the first version. And actually, we're on the third version now. There's always a lag time. You'd like to go out sooner rather than later, but we had to really wait until we felt we had something that would be meaningful to review as far as medical records.
And just to follow up on the validity testing, you do have, and this is great, the automated feedback system, and you had, at least in this report, 130 submissions, and you had some interesting comments here, particularly regarding the denominator. But so my question is, we heard some anecdotal reports here regarding the difficulty with the measure, and I'm wondering if in any of those 130 submissions, if you've heard similar responses in terms of the challenges of this measure.
Difficulty as far as collecting the information or how it's constructed, I'm not sure what your question is.
Difficulty with measuring. I mean, we heard from Louisiana, and I'm just curious.
The fact that you're collecting every single...
Yeah. Okay. Well,
that in that sort of feedback as well in that automated system.
And actually, we really haven't in the automated system. I'm just giving you my experience, having gone out to probably, what did I say, 8 different sites now, each one with a different type of a medical record. Some of them are EMR, some of them are paper-based, some of them are a hybrid where they scan it in. And really, the bottom line is, especially for this measure, you go to the feeding records. That's where you look. And if the baby's there a day or two, you're looking at a couple of days' worth of feeding records. And if the flow sheets are well constructed, it's pretty simple to see, because usually most of them will have a line for breastfeeding, a line for formula feeding, if they have a bottle, what was in the bottle, because sometimes we do allow, they don't have to actually be fed on the breast, it's the breast milk that they receive that we're looking for. So if they've clearly documented it in the flow sheet, I'm not spending more than 5 minutes on a record for the most part. It's a pretty straightforward review of the record. It's not like another project where I looked at blood management, where you might have had a dozen transfusions. That's a lot harder, more labor-intensive. This is fairly straightforward.
I think one of the key systems changes to make it easy for hospitals to collect this measure is actually to tweak your forms to make it real clear how you're supposed to chart and where to look to find the data. Once you do that, things fall into place.
And we also do sample for this measure, so you're not looking at every single medical record as well. So it's based on the number of discharges that you have or deliveries per month, and then you would sample accordingly.
Okay. Can we vote then on scientific acceptability of this measure, the reliability and validity?
Yes, 2 no.
Okay, so we can move on.
Okay, so next for usability, our group thought that the measure was very easy to understand, good for public reporting, good for quality improvement efforts. Public could easily understand what it is. And there's some data presented that has actually made a small difference in 1 year of reporting on the measure.
Okay. Can we vote on usability?
Six moderate and 2 low. And then from a feasibility point of view, we've already discussed the ease of collecting the data. I guess there's some perhaps difference of opinion about it. But our group thought generally that the measure was rated high on feasibility.
with four highs and one moderate.
For those of you who weren't looking at the screen, I wasn't either.
High 9, moderate 12, low 3.
And then overall suitability for endorsement.
Yes, 4, no.
I would just mention that maybe a similar measure could be constructed for the NICU and is already in use, you know, in many consortia. It shouldn't be exclusive milk feeding, of course, but maybe any human milk at discharge was a very highly rated measure by many of the expert panel that we conducted.
Just want to comment on the document itself. Having gone through many of these documents, I think this has been very well put together, mm-hmm. and I just want to comment the group, and this can be put as an example of what the document should be like.
Hi. I just wanted to make one comment, if it's all right. As a person who does report cards and other kind of data reporting at a state level, and I don't have access to charts. I've got to rely on instruments like the electronic birth registration system. I'd just like the Joint Commission to think a little bit about how to harmonize with that. I mean, maybe there should be two versions of the measure, because I'm not sure, but I think the 2003 standard is exclusive breastfeeding at discharge, not exclusive breastfeeding throughout the hospitalization. I can't, if anybody knows better, I'd appreciate that. But, you know, not everybody who's doing these measures and loves them is doing them, you know, has direct access to charts.
I wanted to add to what you're Elliot, probably talking about hospitals that are motivated to support breastfeeding. When you're trying to change behavior in hospitals that aren't motivated to support breastfeeding, and you've got as difficult as this is to collect if you're not setting your system up that way, it's not, you can choose the measure or not. We need to do measures that are also more process-based, looking at, we have baby farming hospitals in Louisiana. That requires a certain architecture of your labor floor. Louisiana, we don't have a single baby-friendly hospital, for example. And so for states that are trying to improve and you're looking at grading them, we've had a heck of a time of what to put on a report card. We have something called the gift certification program that's varied by state, which is getting rid of the formula bag. But I think we can talk about this later, too, but Elliot, you may be leaving. What other types of intermediate process measures have you looked at? Because from a state perspective and the worst performers' perspective, where you want to change behavior quickly, we really just don't have anything that's validated to grade them on. And so we're creating our own as we go.
We started off years ago using the data that was reported on the newborn screening forms, which is a quick but very dirty form of data, because it's often records what the intention was rather than what the reality was. But that's a start as a bridge to get to a more refined measure. But I think the intent here is that this is something that focuses attention on this issue. And makes the hospitals confront it, you know, in a way that can be creative.
If the measure were required, it would be a whole different ballgame. And then we could motivate behavior. But for the non-motivated, we are using newborn screening for our report card. But it's just a single time measure, and then discharge. It sounds like New Jersey's using.
Okay, so we're going to move on. And our next measure is elective delivery prior to 39 completed weeks gestation. Tim. Right.
You think you're able to see that?
Well, not behind Elliot, I can't see it.
Okay, so this is a letter delivery prior to 39 completed weeks, which is 37 to 39 weeks. And this was a very interesting discussion. Pretty much the group felt this had high impact because of the high burden.
Let me see this for one.
Can you use that? All right. Yes, I will. We felt that this was high impact because of the high burden and the relatively, based on several publications, the relatively high number of elective deliveries that were occurring at this time period. We felt that there was a high opportunity for improvement. And so it met the importance goal. There was pretty much consensus around that, and the evidence to support it was pretty good. I think the biggest bugaboo in this indicator was, one, there were very generous exclusion criteria, but even in the face of some of which may not necessarily have been appropriate, but they were very generous in their exclusion criteria. But then there were many criteria that should be excluded that aren't excluded because there are no codes for them. And the one that comes to mind right away is classical C-section. That is a very good reason to have a delivery earlier than 39 weeks, but there's no specific ICD-9 code for it. In general, there was pretty good consensus about that. So I'll open it up for comments.
Yeah, I wanted to comment just a little bit on the exclusions. You know, New Jersey's been working on this for about a year and a half. We saw the 39-week thing as a low-hanging fruit. And we got half the hospital chairs in the state, you know, OB chairs, together to try to get them to sort of jointly agree to a ban. It wound up that hospitals, had to do it, you know, voluntarily and one-on-one, and some hospitals have really hard stops where if you don't have medical documentation, you can't get scheduled, you can't get, you know, admitted, you can't get nursing staff to run the induction and so on. But when a hospital puts a hard stop in like that, then there's response from physicians, most OB physicians. I was doing CMEs, and one deputy chair who was responsible for screening all of these cases said that in the week after they put a hard stop policy in, he had 5 reported cases of oligo in the 38th week that had to be induced, right? And oligo is here on the list, and I was just told, I'm not the provider, you know, I'm not, this isn't my training, but I'm told that oligo is a pretty unreliable measure, and if you do it a couple of times over the course of 2 days, you can get any result you want, right?
Or a dead baby if you wait long enough, so yeah,
it's not. Okay. It's just, you know, that's been the New Jersey experience, that, you know, that you have to be really careful about these.
We looked at the Ohio Perinatal College Collaborative that brought our weight down from around, we decreased it by 60% over a year. And we looked at diagnosis creep, and this data is in published in abstract form, but it's not yet been published in paper form. The elective indications went down, but the indicated did not go up, suggesting that diagnosis creep is not a significant player. At some point, you got to trust people to document the right thing. I'm not saying games don't get played, but I'm just saying on a big picture, it's not happening, at least in Ohio where we looked at it.
Chuck, we had a similar process to what Chuck did in New Jersey, where last year we challenged our hospitals to be 39-week hospitals. We now have 85% of our hospitals are 39 weeks or above hospitals. But our major problem has been measurement. And this measure is difficult. In states like many states, Medicaid does not require ICD-9 modifiers, and so we only have, let's say, 2 for admission, for billing, and so we could not, this would require chart abstraction if we were for every case on every single chart for complicated medical reasons that chart abstractors may not understand. And so the way we've gone is we're revising our vital record system and creating a checklist for each physician delivering that notes the indicated reason, and we've created a consensus panel around what the reasons are, and they were actually more restrictive than these. Again, the classical C-section is an important one that everyone agrees that we've talked to and I agree with as a reason why you would deliver early, but oligo and gestational, depending on suspected macrosomia, some of these are softer indications, but we've added them. They're still on our checklist. But it was important for us to go through this process. I think ACOG needs to be a bigger leader in terms of making stronger statements on 39 weeks and coming and helping providers navigate these decisions. But what about the issue of not having the ICD-9 modifications that would really clearly indicate what these are? And Elliot's actually worked with us trying to help us. But we realized it would be hopeless to try to do it from a billing standpoint, and we've had to go to our vital record system. So it is a challenging measure in that regard. And then people will always question the classical, the absence of that modifier as a very important exception that's missing.
I would comment that we try to build in financial incentives for both physicians and hospitals around this measure, but again, it's not, but you can't see it in the code system, so you can't independently verify it. So for 2000 ICD-10, is there greater specificity in the coding?
Yes and no. there's a lot more codes in ICD-10, but like the prior classical cesarean section, it's not going to be in the first iteration of ICD-10 codes, but I do understand it will be in the next release. So eventually that will be something that can be coded, as will prior myomectomy. That's another one that we hear about as well. But that will be the iteration after the second iteration where we'll see that. So I'm trying to think of some of the other things that we've heard. It's a lot more specific, like if you're doing a procedure, like the right side versus the left side versus lateral versus medial. There's a lot of that when you're looking at procedures, but a lot of the diagnosis codes, not really.
So does this group ever advocate to the AMA that there be specific coding around elective deliveries and gestational age of interest?
Gestational age is another one, I believe, right, Sean? And parity, correct? Okay, those two are coming eventually. And then parity is in the next iteration. So it's coming, but it's not here yet.
Do you know what year are we talking about?
And some states, the state of Texas this year took the tack that they would do Medicaid modifiers for billing that indicated whether the delivery was medically indicated or not. My problem with that, obviously, is there would be a lot of bias in the coding if you're voluntarily stating that you're not going to be paid on your form. My understanding is no state has been able to get around the issue of ICD-9 coders because you're not going to get paid based on whether she, you know, once you go down that very long list of exclusions, that you're not getting paid based on it, there's very little motivation for coders to put those codes in.
I'm from Intelligent Healthcare, from those of you that don't understand that, and we've been very well been able to put this into practice. Again, it is hardest to use ICD-9 codes. We have our own internal system that we're able to pull it out. As far as your question with the oligo and increase in stillbirth, I know there was a recent article in ACOG, and we have a rebuttal to that that will be that we've submitted. We looked at our data last week looking at stillbirth, and we have not seen an increase since we have put this in, so just so everyone is aware of that, and that will be out if it gets accepted.
Also, Kate Chenock is on the phone. Kate, did you hear the discussion? You want to enter a vote for importance for the elective delivery prior to 39 weeks?
I would vote, yeah, it's important. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move to scientific acceptability. And again, we had high on reliability, although two people thought it was moderate, and then we were split on validity, 4 and 4. And again, I think this comes back to the coding. one of the other issues that we didn't address is that another exclusion is active labor or spontaneous rupture. And active labor in particular is not something that can very easily be detected through coding, although there are some algorithms for it. But ultimately, at some point after you get your denominator, there is some chart abstractions that has to happen if you want to be as accurate as possible. And so that's where the issues come. But as a whole, we felt that it was relatively reliable, that it was very reliable and relatively valid.
Can I just ask, I mean, in my hospital too, we're having the same experience. We're going through by hand for all of these anyway after we screen them by the ICD-9s. Is it possible to build in an exclusion for a classical section for those who want to do that? Because we know that classical sections are not equally distributed amongst hospitals. They're much more concentrated in the tertiary care centers. So is there a way to say that if you choose to go through by hand and pick those out, that we will accept that?
As a matter of fact, we can create a data element that would look at prior classical cesarean and prior myomectomy. So that could be accomplished by chart abstraction.
I would throw cholestasis in there too, but...
Actually, the code has changed for that now. It used to be just liver disorder, now it's liver and biliary disorder.
Okay.
So that has been addressed through ICD-9 codes. Also, there's two new codes out, if the coders are using it, that if the mother is in spontaneous labor with a planned cesarean section and they code for that, then they no longer need to look at the record to see if they were in active labor prior to the cesarean section. So this is something that we're looking to build into our algorithm as the first checkpoint, and if they don't code for that, we'll still have the original checkpoints for cesarean section and then whether they were in labor or had SROM prior to the cesarean.
Yeah, just I support this measure. I mean, I think this is a very important measure. But just to echo something that Kim said, and Elliot, I know that you have a response to this, but the denominator, the low risk women, and collecting that data again is challenging. And we did a pilot with 25 hospitals in partnership across 5 states, and it's very difficult to do, certainly for all deliveries. I understand that, you know, you can get a subset, and that's, I think, the answer here. But there are hospitals that do want to, you know, the input data and monitor not just a handful of deliveries. So, you know, I completely support this measure. Particularly the denominator and having that be a low-risk denominator as opposed to, let's say, you know, all early-term deliveries or all scheduled inductions and C-sections. It is a challenge for sure, and I just wanted to make that statement.
I'd just like to ask a question. We again, I think this is a wonderful measure, and I think that it's been so powerful that the country has changed its practice over a short period of time. We've seen dramatic improvement, and so I applaud the developers. My issue in trying to educate physicians about this is, it again, is the glaring exclusion of the previous classical and the previous myomectomy. And so did I understand you to say that we don't have to wait to ICD-10, that there is a workaround? Okay. So, and what was that workaround? Is that going to be something?
You'd have to review the medical records. It would be a chart abstracted data element that we could create and build into the algorithm as an exclusion to the denominator population.
Perhaps if this group recommended that, it might be considered more strongly. I think as we've tried to roll this out over the last several years in California statewide, we learned, first of all, that there's no such thing as low-hanging fruit. This is hard, but it does change practice dramatically. The biggest difficulty here is clearly in data collection, but I think what's happened is as this was recognized and supported by ACOG and others, is that we've started to develop the workarounds to make it easier, to change the ICD-9 codes, to add the classical C-sections. Actually, classical C-sections, every hospital I talk to says that's an issue, but the actual number of prior classical C-sections is quite small. Even in a tertiary center, and it's only a handful a year when you come right down to it. With the other work, we're getting around it in many parts of California by being able to combine vital records and the ICD-9 codes, which gives you gestational age and parity. So if that collection is done, then there's only about 5% of charts that need to be looked at by hand to look at active labor or ruptured membranes. If we change those codes, then it can be done even more easily. There is a problem with sampling, though, Scott, in that the denominator gets pretty small pretty quickly. And if you have a small denominator, in a few cases, you'll get wide fluctuations month to month or quarter to quarter. So I have not been recommending that we do a sampling because we've seen big, big fluctuations in our rates. You know, as to whether the denominator is all 37, 38 weeks versus just the low-risk members of 37, 38 weeks, it's harder to collect the denominator that way, but it makes more sense if you're really looking only at the cases from the low risk to begin with. And that's, I think, why it got set up that way to begin with.
And I know we're not on usability yet, but I think it certainly gets to an issue there as well. Again, I support the measure, but it is a challenge for some.
Would you both be able to speak to, certainly there will be fallout for this measure because of the number of exclusions, patient population, et cetera. One of the things that Ellie and I have talked about previously is that 5% would be a fallout rate that would be acceptable. So you would expect that you would have some of these that would come up in the data. Can you speak to, when you're doing quality improvement, sometimes that's a way to get around the prior classical or your prior myomectomy, is just accepting, if you're doing QI or payment reform based on this, that there will be a fallout. Can you speak to that in your process in choosing that number and how that works in California?
Actually, we do not set benchmarks. We have not set a benchmark, but for those hospitals that do report this measure to the Joint Commission, we set target ranges. Target ranges are based on all hospitals from the previous quarter, how they performed with this measure. So you have a mean and you have a standard deviation above and below, and that particular hospital's rate would be plotted on that graph so they can see how they're performing relative to other organizations that report the measure. This will vary from quarter to quarter depending on how well the nation has performed. So this is actually a moving target range that we have set. In the second quarter of this year, we were around 14%. For all hospitals that reported.
The 5% came from LeapFrog, that also uses the same measure. In a big sampling of California hospitals, and part of them in a Marcy Dimes collaborative program, most of the hospitals have been able to get down into the under 8 and many under 5 to 2%, and that's been the experience in Intermountain Health. I think you're running about 2.2%. 1.9.
Okay, so in the interest of time, I think we should move on here and vote for scientific acceptability of this measure.
Would the acceptance of the infection for a possible being taken out or no?
With the recommendation.
With the,
even without
with
it.
We're measuring on the specifications as they stand.
Yeah, we've heard that before.
Can you tell me on the scientific acceptability of this measure?
I think it needs acceptability. If I get cut off, I'm fully in support of this measure.
Thank you.
Okay, 25 yes, 1 no.
We're now going to talk about usability and feasibility, and again, it was rated highly usable, with two people scoring moderate, and very feasible, with one person scoring moderate, everyone else scoring high. There were some questions about the risk adjustment, and I thought, if I recall the discussion, many people felt that it maybe should not be risk adjusted, and that especially the issue with really sort of detracted from that, from the ability to see disparities. comment?
So, voting on usability.
Okay, voting on usability. High, moderate, low, and proficient.
Moderate.
Thank you. Nine high, 15 moderate, one low.
Moving on.
We talked about feasibility. We felt that it is feasible. The big issues we've already talked about in terms of parity, gestational age, labor. I mean, it's a little intensive, but it's feasible. And so the overall rating was pretty much mixed between high and moderate.
So can we vote?
Kate, you vote on feasibility?
Moderate.
Thank you. One moderate, one low.
And then overall suitability for endorsement?
Kate, you're over there?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. 25 yes, 0 no's.
Can we formally make the recommendation to include previous classical C-section and previous myomectomy? Would that be appropriate at this time to make that recommendation along with this?
Is everyone in agreement with that recommendation?
Yes.
Okay, and so we are moving on to cesarean rate for low-risk first birth women.
Okay, this is my measure, and I was actually quite glad to see that the low risk first birth woman C-section rate has been changed. I never quite understood that metric. I think the NTSB is much clearer. Obviously, getting our C-section rate down is something that has plagued us for. I think the data said 20 years. It's been longer than that. I remember my first month in private practice, my division chief came up to me and said I needed to get my C-section rate down, and I said, I have not done a C-section yet. And they said, it doesn't matter. You need to get that rate down. And obviously, we have been unsuccessful. The rate continues to climb, and so any help that we can get in getting that rate down, I think, would be greatly appreciated. Our work group thought that this was a very important measure, had high impact, and had high opportunity for improvement, and was felt to be very, very important. ACOG mentions that they feel that this measure is probably the optimal measure for cesarean section rate, more so than the total C-section rate or the primary C-section rate, and I think previously that's where people have been trying to put their emphasis. Early data shows that currently nationwide we're at about 27.7%, and I think that the rationale for this is that this measure really kind of looks at the process of labor or the management of labor, and that's where we really need to put our focus. So I'll stop there and would ask the developers if they have any comments.
Just one comment in that this is a measure that really focuses on a group of the subpopulation of cesarean sections that has seen the biggest rise in the last 15 years, besides repeat C-sections. But but it's been labor C-sections has been the biggest contributor to the rise of C-sections. And it's also the biggest source of variation among hospitals and among providers. So this is where most of the variation lies, is in this population of women.
Okay, this is eminently usable. So it's looking at the thing that we can modify most easily, I mean, without getting into the VBAC argument and complicated arguments. It's simple to measure. We're putting it on our report card. It's useful, I think, for both public reporting as well as provider reporting. It's easy to do. You can abstract it from vital records, which is a godsend. In terms of hospitals wanting to work with you, our hospital association is very supportive of us collecting this measure, reporting this measure, because it does not put a large burden on our providers. I think it's a fantastic measure.
I would add that this is one of the core measures recommended by Secretary Sebelius for use in the Medicaid program. For those of you who maybe don't realize that the Medicaid programs collectively pay for at least half, probably now clearly half, given the recession, of the babies born in this country. In other words, about 2 million a year. And in the stakeholder group that developed those recommendations for the secretary, there was wide representation of a variety of perspectives, including states that were concerned about data collection and burden and so on, and it was overwhelmingly endorsed. So it is certainly highly recommended by the Medicaid programs.
This measure was first endorsed in 2008, and maybe this is just a silly question, but why it hasn't had impact on the rate? Or has it decreased the rate of increase? Can we make it required?
I think there's a difference between endorsement and then being used by either insurance companies, by linking the payment, by people like the Joint Commission that have picked it up, and other groups. So it takes a few years to actually get into play, is what we're seeing. But I think you need an additional incentive to go with the measure to make change sometimes. And I think this is one that's going to need some incentives involved.
And for what it's worth, we have about 200,000 deliveries a year, and the rate is stable, so there's been no increase in it.
Stable at a very high level.
same with the national data.
Mm-hmm. I think this is one where we not only need system issues, but we need a lot of patient education about this measure.
I think the nice thing about this, and along with the one we just looked at, the 39-week, is that it's all tied in with inductions, so there is something that hospitals know that they can look at. If they're found to be an outlier on this, there's an obvious sort of place to look to change practices.
We see huge regional variation in this rate around the country, lowest in the north central region, very high in the southwest, the southeast. So there's something also about the culture of how we talk to patients, how physicians train, maybe that has to be addressed as well.
And how patients accept what we say. So that's the other thing, is that I don't think there's some variation in what patients' expectations are. Some demand what they demand, and others are willing to listen to reason.
Right. So. And these regional patterns match hysterectomy patterns around the country,
yeah.
So it's all tied in. Mm-hmm.
Who is the handheld mic? Okay. Don't you have it, Doctor?
Hi, I'm Steve Platten. I'm an anesthesiologist from Boston, and I would offer one caution. Epidurals got blamed for C-sections for a very long time. When you all looked at, what are the things that we know that increase the risk for cesarean delivery, control for all those things, and then she said, see, all that's left is the epidural, that must be that. As it turned out, it probably means that pain was a marker for dysfunctional labor, and those women asked for an epidural, and that's what the prospective randomized trials have shown. The concern that I would have is it means there's something that happens in labor that we don't measure very well and can't understand very well, And all of those things that we try to say are risk factors for labor aren't the whole picture. And I'm just wondering how you're going to deal with that.
Okay. Any other comments? Are we able to vote on at least the first part of this measure? Importance to measure and report.
Kate, are you there?
I'm here. It's
great.
Important.
Okay, thanks. Twenty-five yes, zero no's.
Okay, moving on to reliability and...
For reliability, our work group felt that this was a pretty clean measure. The numerator is C-sections. The denominator is basically defined by the measure name with just a few exclusions. There was some concern during our discussions about the stratification of the data by age. And if I heard correctly during our work group conversation, there was some data to support that. And I would like to ask whoever in the work group had that data. Oh, actually, I brought it up.
a mild question about the risk adjustment by age. And Elliot answered me, and then I went back and looked at New Jersey data, and he was, you know, I see exactly the same thing he does, and that I'm going to start risk adjusting as soon as I get home. For age.
There's a very dramatic, impressive straight line for nulliparous C-sections, and actually C-sections as a whole, from age 18 to 40. It's not something that begins at 30, 35, or 40. It's straight line correlation coefficient of about 0.96. It's pretty dramatically a straight line. So that women at 30 have 7 or 8% higher rate than women at 24. The women at 24 have higher rates than at 18, and it's all the way up the line. So it wasn't just women over 35 or 40, which is in California, which is in San Francisco, my issue, but it's a straight line all the way from 18.
Elliot, is that true for people in spontaneous labor, or is that really a reflection of the practices that the older women have more complications, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, we worried about older, about being a self-fulfilling prophecy about how you care for women over 35 or 40. That's why it was so dramatic to look at women 18, 22, 24, 30, and it was straight line in that time period as well, even up through the early 30s and then 40s. So we felt it was more biological with some issues around, you know, there's self-fulfilling prophecies on how we manage people who are older or more obese or so forth, that's hard to tease out in this. But when you look at the earlier ages and see the same thing happening, that's when we thought it was real.
Okay, we did something similar and then took the infertility singleton patients, which sort of are a marker of the premium births kind of thing, and they just have higher rates that go up also with age. So there's a bump that the premium baby gets, but age, you see the same thing. And did you also look at obesity, stratified by that?
We've done, obesity gets blamed for a lot in this area, but the big bump in obesity comes with morbid obesity. But again, that was very hard to tease out from what the physician's intentions are, from what is biologically related. They weren't necessarily that much bigger babies. So we have not yet done a correction or a risk adjustment for obesity. The one caveat I have would be morbid obesity, maybe a different one, and that is increasing, but it's still a small proportion of all the obesity and overweight that we are seeing in the U.S.
I would just add that in our outcomes measures, morbid obesity is showing up as important, but not obesity in general, probably because obesity is so common at this point.
Okay. If there's no further comment, can we vote on the reliability and validity of this measure. Kate, do you want to?
Yes, support.
Thank you.
Twenty-five yes, zero no's.
John, to usability.
Well, the usability for our work group that we had had some discussion about the risk adjustment that we've already talked about, but with that exception, we found it to be highly usable. And I think to answer some of the previous questions of why haven't we seen improvement previously, I think that from a user standpoint, I think it was poorly understood at first. The low risk first birth, I think, was a bit confusing. And, of course, we didn't know where the data was. Now we've had some time to collect that. And so hopefully the usability with quality improvement going forward will be demonstrated.
One comment I'd like to make is we have been collecting the 39 weeks measure for about a year now for the March of Dimes, and one thing we have seen is we have dropped our C-section rate from about 39% to 32%, and the only measure we've done is the 39 weeks measure. So I'm wondering if once the 39 weeks measure goes into place, if it won't affect this measure as well with the C-section measure, because we have seen that.
Okay, so I think we can vote on usability of this measure.
Yes, it's usable.
It's a high, moderate, low, insufficient information?
High.
Okay, awesome. Thanks. It's 23 high, 2 moderate.
Yeah, I just want to echo what Rebecca said before. From the point of view of a state official or somebody outside the healthcare system, this is exactly what I'm talking about, a measure that's harmonized with what we can do. I can do this. I can't do the 39. I can't do it in the way that's endorsed here. And I kind of wonder why one measure has to have so many exclusions and the other one doesn't. But, that's for future thought. But thank you.
We specifically designed this measure to have two specifications that are really pretty much the same. One that's able to be used with vital records and one that's done in a more typical joint condition manner. So it has double set of specifications you'll see in the application.
So this measure has its first births, right? So can you get first births out of vital statistics data?
Yeah.
But you can't get it out of claims data, right?
To agree with Chuck, we ought to be thinking more along the lines from a public health standpoint and population improvements in population health of how to use viral records more effectively for measure creation. And whether if we do need to modify them, how do we do that regionally or nationally?
and create technical assistance to states who are trying to do this, because it is very challenging. But this is a perfect example of how that works very well.
I guess my question would be what the correlation is between the two between the two specifications that you propose. And to some degree, if the correlation is really, really high, I wonder why we didn't need both, if one of them can be done post hoc without anybody having to go in and extract data.
Not every state is there yet in terms of why not. A lot of states haven't been able to release vital stats data or use vital stats data for these kind of purposes for many months to a year or two after the fact, and so it's that degrades its value as a quality metric. There is some quality improvement work that may need to be done on some state birth certificates for presentation. In California, we had to work on that some. So there's some work that you have to do as a state if you're going to take this on as a state to make certain your data is clean as possible. In terms of head-to-head trials, we've not done a big assessment of that. It is a lot more time consuming to go through the charts to do this, which is, again, why it hasn't had wide acceptability in many states yet, because A, the Joint Commission is not required, and B, unless you use vital stats, you have to do chart review to do this measure. And that's so difficult.
To some degree, it feels like we're shifting the burden. Maybe this should be a statewide burden, but we're shifting it to the hospital. I'm not sure if it should be a statewide burden or a hospital burden, but maybe that's a worth discussion to have, because I guess what we're doing here then is shifting it squarely onto the hospital, right? Well, the state, if they do the vital statistics, but, I guess the other states, you could kind of say, like, well, if you're not ready, like, go get ready.
Okay, so if we can vote on feasibility.
Kate, is it high, moderate, or low for you?
Moderate.
Thanks. Oh. 16 high, 9 moderate, 0 low.
Moving on. So, did you have a comment? Overall suitability for endorsement for this measure? Kate? Yes, no?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, 25 yes, 0 no's.
So next up is appropriate use of antenatal steroids. This is another Joint Commission measure. And this measure, just to remind people, was the numerator is a full course of antenatal steroids prior to delivery and in that episode of care, I should say. And the denominator would be babies between 24 and 07 weeks. Up to 32 and 07 weeks. In terms of, this is sort of a no-brainer actually, in terms of the data is there's lots of it, as well as clinical guidance from NIH, from ACOG, from everyone you can imagine, suggests that the appropriate standard of care for these babies is to get a dose of, or to get a course, I should say, of antenatal steroids if they fall between those gestational ages, with excellent evidence that it will decrease the risk of RDS and NEC for these babies. So in terms of importance to measure and report, everyone in the group felt that it was high impact. In terms of improvement or whether or not there was a gap in sort of what people are doing, is that there was clearly room for improvement based on the data that was presented. And although there's been some improvement, which was good to see, to your point, Scott, there was clear data that it had been tested and some places had seen some improvement, there's still a ways to go in this population. And the work group also felt that it obviously met importance. I don't know if there was anything that I left off that occurred on the work group in terms of this. I can't remember, honestly. Any comments or concerns? Jennifer?
Can Jacob comment on why it's a full course as opposed to a partial course? One of the things we see is we see patients show up in late labor, we get them a dose of steroids, but you can't hold them off for the full 48 hours.
I know originally when the measure was endorsed, they were looking at just the initiation of it, but when our technical advisory panel met to review the measures, they felt that we should be looking at a full course. One thing that we have done in our measure specifications is, that we would look at patients if they've received, let's say, one dose and then they deliver before the 24-hour period, that would be an implied reason why they didn't get the full course, so therefore they would be removed from the measure. So that's forthcoming in specifications beginning with January 1, 2011 discharges, because we did hear that loud and clear from the field.
Okay, so just to clarify, starting in January of next year, that if you deliver before the full course, that excuses you?
Excludes
you, thank you, from the measure.
That's correct. 12, I'm sorry. Yeah, got about a month to go, and that'll be...
So it excludes you, or it's a hit?
I'm sorry?
It excludes you?
It excludes you from the measure. They would be taken out of the measure.
So just for the non-clinicians in the room, I should have mentioned this, I didn't. Full course means that you get your first shot, and then 24 hours later you get your second shot, and then hopefully deliver 48 hours after the first shot. So it is not inconceivable that women will come in, they'll get the first shot, while you're waiting around to give the second one, they deliver. So this is sort of for the non-clinicians in the room. I should have mentioned that. And the other issue is that if you use dexamethasone, then it's 2 6-hour and you're getting 4 doses.
It would just seem that's appropriate care, so that you wouldn't be excluded. You would count as a hit.
Taking out of the denominator. Right, so the point is that we are saying that you shouldn't get penalized for something that you can't control, because cocolytics don't work, so someone's going to deliver before your 48 hours.
Question, Celeste, do the specifications that you submitted to us include that change?
Yes, it's in the data element, reason for not administering antenatal steroids.
Okay.
It's spelled out in there, in the notes for extraction.
Can you clarify, I noticed that you went down to 32 weeks instead of 34 weeks.
Right. When we worked with this measure, with the original measure developer, I think there's some evidence that they haven't had, and I might get this wrong, premature rupture, that you could go up to 34. So it wasn't as clear cut if you were allowing if and or. So the decision was made to simplify it and just look at that discrete 24 to 32 week period. That was the reason.
So I think it wasn't it to sort of mirror the NIH consensus so that we wouldn't penalize people. Because the NIH consensus, that was a lot of the discussion was 32 to 34 and back and forth. And
I guess
on side, and I think they arbitrarily said, okay, 32 weeks. And so I think that this sort of mirrors that.
Well, the NIH said 24 to 32 for ruptured membranes, and then 24 to 34 intact, and said, ruptured 32 to 34. So I guess I'm just concerned that by endorsing this measure, then there's this 32 to 34 week group with intact membranes that I want to make sure we're not sending the wrong message.
Hi, I'm Jelly Glenn from Parkland Hospital, and over there we are constant held the debate with the obstetricians because of some of the controversies that you have mentioned. One is hypertension, and the other one is diabetes. And the previous old literature, which this was based on, had clinical trials which were done in hypertensive women where there was an increase in fetal death. In those hypertensive women, and also there are multiple other reasons why it might not be suitable for mothers who have diabetes. So those are two exclusions that our obstetricians in our hospital have for the antenatal steroids. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, this would be looking at the evidence, and I'm trying to remember if I saw anything in the evidence that there were any harms. I don't believe in the evidence that we reviewed that we saw that. So I guess I'm going to bring my expert up here to...
Can you repeat that again?
In our hospital, two of the exclusion criteria for antenatal steroids, one is hypertension and the second one is diabetes. And the reason which we have given is that in the previous Cochrane analysis which was done, they had not specifically looked into hypertensive women. And one of the trials which had looked into hypertensive women, there was an increase in fetal death. And so there is a concern for fetal death from that. And then diabetes, one of the concerns is that, yes, it can cause hyperglycemia. It may inhibit surfactant action and all those concerns. So I don't know what the recent literature is, recent evidence is on that.
Yeah, I think the Cochran's had that response. Most of the patients who are receiving this are on constant monitoring. And so there's not thought to be a very big concern about fetal death and the glucocorticoids. I think that's diminished in the literature. As far as diabetics, certainly the glucocorticoids can put that diabetic in poor control, and that has to be dealt with. Nevertheless, the benefits are thought to far outweigh the risks in that regard.
So, Mike, do you have a response in terms of this, what Kim's bringing up, in terms of the 32 to 34-week cessation, and sort of where does that leave us with the intact membranes? I'm sorry, I should clarify.
You know, I think the reason we chose that, again, was to avoid trying to break it out into when the membranes ruptured and when did they rupture. I haven't seen any trend that we're pushing patients or pushing docs not to give the steroids between 32 to 34 weeks. So I would continue it at this 32 weeks for the simplification. I would perhaps add one note for the future, and that is the concern that we're overusing steroids, which is happening across the country, and people are using it like water. Every patient now in so many community hospitals, as well as the academic hospitals, are getting steroids the moment they walk in with a contraction at 25 weeks. And the vast, vast majority of those are not delivering within the 7 to 14 days. I don't know if we have we noted that it's a 7-day efficacy, but is that counted in the... We don't look at that. And that might be something to long-term consider is the number of courses of the steroids, as well as whether you're giving it within an appropriate time window of perhaps 14 days, but for future discussion.
So I'm a little bit humored. I think in 2008 we had a lot of discussion about this measure and a very similar measure from Vermont Oxford, and the main reason that we ended up endorsing this measure was that it included the 32 to 34 weeks exclusions for women with ruptured membranes, because the obstetricians felt very, very strongly about this, And, you know, on the other hand, we try to make the argument like, okay, like, you know, as you heard yesterday, about 80% of VLBW infants are already captured by the VON, and they're already collecting this data. But it was felt to be the more scientifically pure and in line with NIH guidelines to address the 32 to 34 weekers. So we had this big trade-off between trying to be perfect versus good enough. And the perfect one out, and now we're going back to good enough, which I'm not against that, but I would just kind of caution about extra data collection again for something that like 80% of VLBW patients are already submitting somewhere. I guess the other point that I would make, and I understand we're in line with the guidelines at 24 weeks, I can't tell you for a neonatologist how frustrating it is to receive a 23 and 4 weeker from the community that has not gotten steroids because it didn't hit 24 weeks. And I guess my last comment would be that I feel like the evidence for antenatal steroids on outcomes on babies is probably stronger than anything else we have in neonatology. So, you know, I'm fully supportive of having some kind of antenatal steroid measure.
So are you suggesting, what exactly are you suggesting?
So I'm not, I know there's no Vermont-Oxford measure on here, so to harmonize and to think about. It's probably because they didn't want to resubmit after the last discussion we had. But I do think, you know, we need to be cautious I think for this round, I'd be really supportive of this measure, but I feel like if there's another round, you know, in the future where, you know, we would have, you know, if the one would resubmit, I'm trying to be really conscientious about hospitals not duplicating work. And I think that should be, you know, I think that's a wasted effort. All of us who work hard on quality improvement and trying to make things better are competing for resources in hospitals to do anything on the front lines. And so if money flows into a duplication of efforts on measures that are very similar, you know, that money is not available to do good things for patients. So I just want to be conscientious about that. I don't think we can do anything about the 24-weekers for this measure. I mean, that's fine. But I would maybe this could be brought to ACOG, or I'm not sure if you have representatives from ACOG who could, you know, like allude to the fact that at what point it'll be brought up to extend, the measure criteria maybe to, or to investigate whether this is going to be a beneficial for babies that are just below 24 weeks.
So I think, though, to speak to that last thing, I mean, I think that we would be looking for some clinical guidance before you could measure whether or not people are doing it. I think we need some clinical guidance that's very clear with compelling evidence that says we should be ratcheting down what we're doing, and because you're going to measure if you go to 23 and a half or whatever the number is a huge variation in opinion from neonatology as well as obstetrics, and that's going to be a mishmash of who knows what it is. So I think, you know, if that's an issue, then we need to take that back to both AAP and ACOG to take a look at that 23 to 24 week gestation and come up with some guidelines that all of us can live with.
Yes, I'm just suggesting that maybe we can make a recommendation as a committee that should be an important thing to be looked at in the future, because it's almost like when we say, you know, when we enshrine it at 24 to 0, you know, with this measure, that, you know, it'll drive practice even more so. And so I feel like at least we can make a recommendation maybe that this is something that should be investigated, studied, or discussed at least. I'm not sure we're able to get a trial on these babies together.
I just want to make a comment. This measure is up for its maintenance review, and as Dr. Prophet mentioned, there has been a change. And so I think that's something you need to factor in, because in the course of the prior endorsement, it had one set of specifications that now have been modified, as you've commented on, to a significant degree. So that is an important aspect of its, you know, sort of maintenance review, is how the measure evolves and changes.
Can we vote on importance to measure and report?
Kate, are you still with us? Kate?
Okay. So moving on to scientific acceptability, I think within the work group we talked about it already. We felt that the reliability of the measure was high. Five felt that, and one moderate. And then in terms of the validity, again, the vast majority of the work group felt that it was highly valid. I don't know that there was any other discussion. Do people feel that there are other things that need to be clarified? Feel that we can vote? Oh, yes. Yep.
There's a little corner discussion going over here. The issue of excluding from the measure anybody who starts the course but doesn't have a chance to complete it before the baby is delivered, you know, that means that you don't get credit for starting the course, right? And so while it's not in the denominator either, I mean, you don't get credit for a lot of attempts at good healthcare. So I'm just wondering if, you know, if you thought about the pros and cons of giving credit. I know it's defined as full course, and that's obviously a trade-off. You want to comment? Or have you?
There's both ends of that spectrum. One may be that the patient comes in, doc does a great job, and gives the can only give a course, you know, half a course or a few hours before delivery. The other is you wouldn't want to just sort of allow that and say, oh, we forgot to give this, well, an hour before she's about to deliver, let's go give her a dose. So I think excluding them is probably the wisest for the present time.
So can I just follow up with that and take some help from my OB colleagues who know the literature better, but is it clear that a full course, two doses, is absolutely necessary? My understanding is that there's a little bit of, that's not crystal clear in the literature, that one dose, even, you know, 48 hours and beyond, it can be beneficial. So I am concerned, you know, Chuck's point is an important point, plus, you know, this is locking us into a full course, pretty much, of two doses, right? I mean, if I'm reading this correctly.
Yeah.
The literature, as most of the open studies, is controversial. The vast majority of studies that were originally done to report on the efficacy used complete dosages. And yet there are select studies that, you're correct, show that independent of the full dose or even the time to completion may not have a difference of effect as compared to the full dose on certain outcome parameters, particularly bronchopulmonary dysplasia. Nevertheless, I think the majority of the literature and obstetricians would believe that the full dose is what's really most effective for the prevention of at least the acute outcome of respiratory distress syndrome.
Also, I think that we're at this point in practice where I don't know how you're actually going to get the answer to your question. I mean, I think it's a daily debate on every unit when you get that person who comes in and you're like, she's not going to make the 24 hours. Should we do 212? Is there data to support that? I don't think anybody knows. Some people do it, other people don't. And I feel as though you can see studies which, you know, they're small, you know, so I don't know that we're going to be able to answer that question.
I'd like to ask our perinatologist if you all, I mean, you may have just answered with no data, but at national meetings, this question has been posed, what's the latest time that you can give steroids? And the answer was just before the ears come out. So, you know, just nobody really knows, and is it advantageous to give it at that late date? So I just don't know.
Do you have a sense in looking at the data for babies that are appropriate for steroids but get only one dose? How often is it a quality issue versus it just a time and no opportunity?
We really haven't looked at that, so I guess I couldn't answer that. As far as, it seems though, when we do get inquiries into the measure, the majority of the time it's because they have delivered prior to, or, you know, before they could get the second dose. That appears to be the issue for the most part, I would say. A couple of cases where there was a documented congenital anomaly incompatible with life, so that would have been the reason why they wouldn't have needed the steroids as well.
Right. So by excluding them, you're leaving good behavior. You're not accounting for some good behavior that hospitals could get credit for.
Other questions? Oh, to answer your question, I don't think anybody knows how short a time. Kim's whispering in my ear. She thinks she's heard 4 hours. I have no idea. I haven't heard anything. I just give it until I see that literally the ears come out. I think the reason that you get that answer is because we cannot predict when someone's going to deliver. I think that that's the main issue, is that we don't have good predictors. 50% of the people won't, you know, who come in with contractions won't deliver, but I don't know which 50% necessarily, in which case that's how I think we creep into that everybody gets it the minute they have one contraction, which I agree with you is going to be, you know, in a few years is going to be a real issue. I'm not so sure that we can get at that, though, people getting too much steroids. I think we can get at people getting too many repeated courses, the same patient getting repeated courses, which we now have good data to suggest that's a bad idea. But I don't know how you would ever be able to measure that people are giving it with every contraction for every woman.
I guess I've been thinking in the future of the number of patients who received it and then did not deliver preterm, or the number of patients who have received one dose and then didn't deliver at least for 2 weeks later. And that's where we're sliding into this overuse, which has effects potentially on fetal growth and neonatal outcomes. Adverse effects.
So if there are no further questions or comments, can we vote on the reliability and validity of the measure? Kate, are you back on?
I'm back. I'm sorry. I'm going through security. Hi.
Hi. That's okay. That's a lot to handle.
Yeah. We're on scientific acceptability of the antenatal steroids measure.
Right, it's one or high, whatever the highest category is.
That's how you leave your license as you're going through the thing.
Twenty-four yes, one no.
And then moving on to, thank you. Moving on to usability. I think in the work group we talked a lot about documentation, but most people felt it was highly usable and. We're sort of split on feasibility between high and moderate, but for the most part, we felt that it was feasible. I mean, I do think that, you know, the issue of chart review and resources, et cetera, definitely came up. There's no easy way of doing this currently. Lee.
I would just volunteer that a process similar to that used for developing the child and maternity care related measurements set for Medicaid programs took place over this past year with respect to a set of measures for adults who are enrolled in state Medicaid programs. And this was one of the measures that actually ended up being on the final list that was sent to the Secretary for her consideration and ultimate, we hope, approval, but that process is still underway.
Kate, this is a high, moderate, low, insufficient information. Feasibility, I already actually discussed it, but feasibility, can we vote on that?
Six high, 16 moderate, 2 low.
Okay, and so finally, are there any other comments or questions before we go on to the final? Okay, so overall suitability for endorsement for this measure.
Kate, are you back with us?
She probably forgot to take something off, and so poor thing is now being searched. Push one more time, everybody, please.
Okay. 24 yes, 0 no.
We are moving on to the final one of the morning. Healthcare-associated bloodstream infections in newborns. Scott, you're on.
Thanks, Laura. Okay, this is healthcare-associated bloodstream infections in newborns. We discussed three related measures yesterday. This one assesses the number of staphylococcal and gram-negative septicemias or bacteremias in high-risk newborns. We went through some of this data yesterday, but for some of those that weren't here, in terms of impact, this is a significant problem, particularly for high-risk infants, very low birth weight infants in particular. And infections result in increased length of stay, as well as increased hospital costs and charges. And the other risk factors include central venous catheter use, prolonged time using parenteral nutrition, or prolonged time with mechanical ventilation. This is also very well written, I want to add as well. There's a nice summary here about effective preventive measures and quite a bit of detail on that in this write-up. In terms of opportunity for improvement, there are a couple of notes in here about the how this rate varies widely across different centers in terms of healthcare-associated infection rates. They note between 6% and 33%, and that educational interventions in particular are noted here in terms of being able to decrease catheter-related bloodstream infections from, very significantly, as noted here. And so in terms of the work group, we pretty much rated this in terms of importance to measure and report high, with one being moderate. We note that this measure is very similar to measure 478, and so we do have this general agreement on the high impact, and the issue did come up again here in terms of when patients are transferred from the hospital that Elizabeth may want to comment on. You'll also see, I think you brought that up in our discussion, if I remember correctly. You don't have to comment on it, if you want to. In terms of evidence, we rated in terms of quantity, quality, consistency, moderate and high. And so I'll just pause there and see if there are any questions or comments for the developers.
Sorry, can you just remind us how you handle transfers, and then I'd be happy to comment.
For the larger birth babies,
We're looking at those that are, I'm blanking now. Greater than 1,500 grams, that's it. We would take anybody that was transferred in within 2 days of birth. They would be considered high risk, because that typically would mean that the baby has problems. They're being moved from a smaller facility to a tertiary facility, so therefore they would be part of the measure that we would evaluate them just on the fact that they were transferred in.
I wanted to ask, in the brief description, it talks about staphylococcal and gram-negative septicemia, and then on the numerator, it talks about different ICD-9 codes, not being familiar with those. Do you would also include enterococcal and fungal isolates as well?
I don't have it memorized, but I know some of those are in the list. Yes.
So, sorry, just to go back to the transfer for a minute, my brain's slowing down after all these measures. Can you tell POA with the POA code whether there is infection on? I think I remember that you can. In which case, that makes perfect sense to me what you're doing.
Whether it was present on
right.
A patient,
right?
Right. Yes. There is a way of identifying that through ICD-9 codes, and we're working through that right now,
okay.
Taking a look at how this could be facilitated.
I mean, in general, what we've tried to do in our hospital-based outcomes measures is. We usually attribute the outcome to the first admitting hospital, which also takes responsibility for the management of the patient going forward. And in this case, I think it's tricky to, if the patient's coming from another hospital, to attribute the infection to the second hospital unless you can be sure it wasn't present on admission.
For a hospital receiving a baby that's infected, it would be the principal diagnosis code, so that's how you would
okay.
exclude them from that. In a hospital that has the baby delivered there, the principal code will be a V30 code. That occasions the reason for being admitted is that they were born. That's always going to be the first code, and then we'd be looking at other diagnosis codes that would be present on admission to exclude them if they were born with an infection at the reporting hospital.
And I think that in the end, you probably just can't know for sure, right, if that baby's been a couple days at another hospital where they acquired an infection.
That might.
I don't have a
yeah.
problem with it because there's
yeah.
no perfect answer to the
right.
transfer. You're always sharing with me. I did have a separate comment. One of the things I thought it would be good for you to talk about is the variation in the measure. So this is a risk-adjusted outcomes measure, and the challenge we have with risk-adjusted outcomes measures where we go ahead and quantify the uncertainty associated with the estimates is that if we're careful to quantify the uncertainty, sometimes we just can't see statistically significant variation. So in 2B5, 0.3, which is on page 20, you report, and I think this is really helpful, the range of scores, and there is a range, and the 90th percentile score is 1.64%, and the 10th is 0, all the way through the 75th is 0%, but there aren't statistically significant results from the target range. I assume you're using the 95% confidence interval there, but I'm not sure it's stated. So I don't personally have a major issue with that for this measure, but I just think it's important to think about the way the results look on the measure for other people on the committee and options you can pursue that are reasonable to me but not necessarily to everyone. If you're using a really, really tight confidence interval like 95, which you want in a clinical trial, you can back off of that and you potentially will see outliers. I don't need to know personally 95% certainty that something statistically different from a mean if I'm thinking about a quality measure. So anyway, there may be some ways that you can adjust the reporting strategy so that you see more variation even without adjusting your modeling. That's what I'm saying.
Anyone else?
Okay. So it sounds like we're ready to vote.
Can I ask one quick question? Does that include early on? You're including early on infections, right? There's no, the baby doesn't have to be 3 days old or 72 hours. So this could be, so you're just including those because your thought is that the incidence is so low that it doesn't change the measure overall?
We're looking at newborns up to 120 days of hospitalization.
I guess, you know, theoretically, like, you know, if the number is very low and you think it's insignificant, it makes sense. But like, clinically, find it a little hard to attribute an early onset infection to a hospital when that is something that's already present in the, when the baby is essentially a fetus still. And, so this is an infection begins before birth. It's hard to attribute the outcome to the hospital.
Yeah, we discussed that with chorio and group B strep and E. coli, the early onset infections, but I can't recall the pediatrician's issues on this. Good.
And I believe, I'm trying to remember how this went when our panel met to discuss this, because we did have neonatologists addressing exactly what you said, and they looked over the list of the codes that we're identifying here, and they felt that it would identify those that were born with infections, and I don't have the list in front of me right now, but that was the consensus of the panel at that point in time.
The denominator exclusions identify the babies that were born with
infections? Right, yeah, it's one of the first ones, the ones that are born with it. There's a couple of tables that identify them. I think it's 11.2 or 11.10.2.
Yakum, do you want to look at that before we vote?
It's like I don't have all the ICD-9 diagnosis codes in my head, but I feel like it would be important, I think, for acceptability within the community to make sure that that is the case. Probably the overall rate of early onset sepsis is going to be very low, so I doubt it'll even make a difference. But I think just in terms of general face validity, it's something I think I'm sure it would have come up on your expert panel, so I don't know if there's an easy way to just look at it quickly, but I don't want to hold up the committee for this because I'm not sure how big the impact is. I couldn't believe that you would have not noticed or gotten feedback on that.
Craig has some help for us.
When I look at denominator exclusions, it does talk about length of stay less than 2 days, so that would catch most of the early onset group B strep and also probably E. coli. So I assume that's what the pediatricians are referring to.
I don't think so. That is only for the clients. These are, why would you have my sister?
Can you use your mic, please?
Yeah, I'm just saying, I don't think that was accurate. I think that the exclusions are length of stay less than 2 days. That's getting it done. Yes, if there is an infection in the first 2 days, that is not excluded. It's my understanding of this number. Is that correct?
Only if they are discharged within the first days are they excluded. That's correct.
So it does say in 2A1.9, patients with ICD-9 principal diagnosis code for sepsis are excluded. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, so those would be the babies that are transferred in with the infection, because that would be the reason for the admission. Would be the principal code that would be, or the reason for the admission.
But they do have POA documentation now, so it should be coded as present on it.
I think you're saying the same thing. So any principal diagnosis code as a reason for admission, it's just explicitly on and there already on admission.
But every newborn has the primary diagnosis as newborn.
But this is a transfer in, so the reason for admitting the baby to the hospital is sepsis. So then it has to be present on admission if it's in the primary discharge diagnosis field, because by definition that's, in retrospect, the reason for which the baby's admitted.
So that's great if you're a transfer. That doesn't address the issue. If you're an inborn baby who has GBS,
Yeah, I'm sorry, I couldn't remember this quite, but it does say diagnosis codes for newborn septicemia are excluded. So newborn septicemia, what usually covers early onset sepsis.
The newborn GVS or E. coli was excluded, but again, I can't remember which codes we used. So.
I guess this goes into the reliability of the extraction and how the coders use it, but usually newborn septicemia is for early onset disease, and then there's like acquired, there's a different code for acquired disease, but I guess there would be a question about reliability of the extraction in that case.
Are we all okay with up now?
It seems like it is important to know whether
your microphone.
Seems like it is important to know that differentiation, whether it is there or not. The measure title itself says healthcare-associated bloodstream infection. And if we don't know that, it is difficult to vote one way or the other.
I think he's saying that he sees it.
Well, neonatal septicemia is used for both early onset sepsis and late onset sepsis. So newborn sepsis can be either late or early. So we don't know that.
I don't know if you have access to the table that's referred to at that part of the, where that exclusion's written up, table 11.1, because it doesn't seem to be in our folder of appendices. Someone has a great.
Here. Yeah. So I'll read it out to the group that's here. Table 11.10, newborn septicemia or bacteremia is septicemia or sepsis of newborn and bacteremia of newborn. Table number 11.11 is newborn bacteremia. That includes group D, strep or enterococcus, staphylococcus unspecified, Staphylococcus aureus, other staphylococcus, Friedlander's bacillus, which is also Klebsiella pneumonia, E. coli, or Pseudomonas. That's table 11.11. Then table 11.12, is that included in this as well? Nope, table 11, so okay, sorry. So table 11.10 and 11.11. Yeah, I didn't see 11.10.2. Okay, so the question is, and we have to rely on our neonatologists to help us figure this out, is that an answer to the question or no?
We still don't know the answer, but I would assume that the developers have gone through this and looked at this carefully because, as the title itself suggests, that it is healthcare-associated infection. So early onset newborn sepsis should be excluded from that. I would assume that they have done it. But we don't know that for sure. So I think it is, assuming that they would have done it, it is probably okay to go ahead and
so assuming that that is an exclusion,
mm-hmm.
then we feel comfortable voting on this.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll double check that.
Okay. Is everybody okay with that?
Top page 16 help you? The developers.
Okay, that's the calculation algorithm. I'm actually looking at the table right now. Okay, table 11.10.2,
would be the table would they come in with a principal diagnosis of sepsis from another hospital, and we're looking at streptococcal septicemia not specified method, MSRA, septicemia, staphylococcal septicemia, pneumococcal septicemia.
We're not disagreeing with the bugs. We're disagreeing with we recognize it transfers. We're all on board with
okay.
that. The question is, if you're born in that hospital and you got infected in labor and you now go to the NICU, the concern is if there isn't a code that suggests that you were infected in utero or you got infected in the first 24 hours, it's not the NICU's fault. It's the uterus, or I don't know.
Okay, so
it's not the NICU,
right? So for those babies, for those babies that are born there, of course the principal code is the B30, and then we'd be looking at another diagnosis code that would be a sepsis code from table 1110. And there's two codes: newborn bacteremia, newborn septicemia. Those would be the two codes we're looking at. However, we have become aware that it goes up to the first 28 days of age that you would code for that. So we're looking at the present on admission flagging of the ICD-9 code to identify that.
Does that work? I don't know.
This is the discussion that we had with ARC as far as harmonization of the measure.
It kind of works, but it doesn't act really, because when the newborn comes in, you don't know whether that baby is septic. So you have probably a diagnosis of evaluation for sepsis rather than neonatal septicemia at that point. So you don't know that at the beginning.
There's actually two ways it can be flagged, where it's known or unknown, and we'd only accept if it's known. So it'd be the way that it's documented in the medical record is my understanding of that.
Yeah, the documentation in the initial 48 hours until we get the cultures back will be evaluation of sepsis and not neonatal sepsis.
I guess one way around that was just to look at, you know, day of life 72 hours and just call it a late onset sepsis measure. And I think you're out of the worry about the contamination there.
For once, the two neonatologists agree.
That means we've been here too long.
Okay, I think I've got it. I don't know for sure. At the bottom of page 15. Eleven point one oh, it says to stop processing, so I think that's the initial septicemia table.
Has anyone looked at
so does that answer the question? To me it says if it's initial septicemia, newborn septicemia, you stop.
I think we're just asking how clearly is that defined? Does that have a time limit on it? Like it's in the first two or three days, that code? Or if it's in the first 30 days, then you're potentially, babies get out of the measure who actually had a hospital-acquired infection. If they, day 15, they get an infection and that's coded as one of those codes.
Can you turn the mic on or just, like, move up and just talk into that? Because we can't hear you back there. It's okay. Scoot your chair up.
Here. And I hate to loom over everybody, but I will. I just want to make sure that I understand what the issue is. And so please reframe me if I'm incorrect. But if I'm understanding correctly, the question is, our patients who are, our babies who are born already infected, eliminated from this measure? And the answer is maybe. And it's not a fault of the measure, it's a fault of the identification system, of the coding system. There is no way to identify somebody using a code who was infected in your utero. We've done the best we could to eliminate those people with the babies with the secondary diagnosis of septicemia or some sort of an infection, But if you all can share with us a good, reliable method of identifying those patients who are born infected, that would be a terrific help to us because we can't do it now as far as we know.
So, Jalil, can you repeat? I mean, I got the impression that you were saying if you just started at day 3 of life instead of day...
It doesn't matter. An infected person is an infected person, and there's no way to say, okay, the infection, no easy way to say the infection occurred on day 3 of life. Using the codes, what you have is you've got the V30 code, and you have that secondary infection code, and it's very, very difficult to put time constraints on that. Well, like impossibly difficult.
If you're delineating it by bacteria, you know, if you avoided the E. coli and GBS, would that give you more of the hospital-acquired infection?
I think if you avoided the GBS, that would probably help, but I think the incidence is so low, it's meaningless.
It's very low, isn't it?
Like, yeah, it's like 1 in 1,000.
And the E. coli is... But E.
coli sepsis is less prevalent, so you'd want to capture that for sure.
Yeah, that's the other one. But again, the infection rate is so low. That's mainly the E. coli. But you'll not be able to take the E. coli out because E. coli can be a late onset infection as well. So I don't see an easy way out. Well, that's different from the Vermont-Oxford network measure, which only looks at late onset, and I'm not sure how they do it.
And I think I would assume that overall the correlation between the measures would be very high, but you know, I feel like that's maybe work that should be done.
I guess the one other question I have is, have you done a crosswalk to ICD-10s?
Oh, yeah. We actually sent it in, and if they have it, if you're wanting to look that over.
Should be in your files, I'm sure.
Right, yeah. The infection codes, there really wasn't a lot of difference. But boy, the surgical codes, there's 42,000 now.
I think just a general, because our practice for every infection measure too is transfers out, so it's like the exposure time the baby has in the hospital. I think that's going to introduce bias on all of the measures that we have before us. Don't know an easy way around that. There probably isn't. But I think it's just something to consider as we go along here.
So I guess the question here is, okay, so giving it back to you, Dr. Prophet. I mean, this is going to be the perfect versus good enough. I mean, is sort of what we're talking about. I mean, and if the neonatal infection rate in the first couple days from the uterus or wherever it comes from is really, really small, are you still going to get meaningful data out of this measure? Is really what we're talking about.
I think I would want to say yes, but I'm not, I think my confidence is not terribly high about it. And I think there might be at least substantial concern within the neonatal community about this. And I think you'll hear a lot of feedback potentially about that. So, you know, I think it's a valid concern that people have. I'm not sure if you actually tested it or, you know, whether you truly find a big difference, but I think that'll be one of those areas that people will try to, or will at least notice as a concern about the measure.
Maybe at this point we...
If you look, I'm not an epidemiologist, so I don't know what the incidence of early onset sepsis is, but if you look at the patients who are in the NICU, many of those extremely low birth weight babies will receive antibiotics for 5 to 7 days for either proven sepsis or clinical sepsis, suspected clinical sepsis. So there are many babies who do get that, and if you're coding that, that won't be coded as neonatal sepsis.
So maybe what we should do is
go ahead and vote at least on the first part of this, and then I think some of these concerns about how valid it is or reliable will come up. Is that fair? So let's vote on the importance to measure and report.
Kate, did you rejoin us? Yeah, we're on. Yes, 4 no.
Okay, should we keep going?
Let's forge ahead.
Great, we're going to forge ahead here. In terms of scientific acceptability, we've talked a bit already about the numerator and denominator, but in terms of harmonization and comparing to 478, the exclusions are a little bit broader, specifically around length of stay over 120 days and being enrolled in clinical trials. That's my understanding, unless something has happened since I last read this. And then in terms of the group, before I get to that, just getting to reliability. So further reliability studies are being done, I guess, now. And I thought it was interesting, 26 contracted performance measurement system vendors. I didn't realize that there were that many. Yeah?
More than just that.
There are more, okay. And the other thing that I noted in the validity section here was that a couple of exclusions are not addressed in the literature, but were included to harmonize with other measures from, I guess, CMS and perhaps others. And those are specifically length of stay under 120, length of stay over 2, and, I'm sorry, the other way, length of stay under 2, length of stay over 120, and then being enrolled in clinical trials. In terms of the group, and we talked about some of this already, in terms of the transfer piece and I guess in the denominator statement, experienced death, there was some concern about hospitals that have worse outcomes potentially looking better in the measure. And so overall, in terms of reliability, we're mostly in the moderate range as a group, and in our review of validity, also in the moderate range. Questions, comments?
I just have a general comment as a participant, as a measure developer in other contexts, putting measures through NQF. So validity, I think NQF sort of tightened up its words, been more explicit about what it means by validity, and in this very well-written application, the validity that's presented is that JC takes feedback from users on a regular basis about sort of the accuracy of the data, and I think data validity, the codes used to capture what we're trying to capture, and that's important. But NQF is requiring now that face validity, that expert panel assessment of measures be quantified systematically. So we take votes on our expert panels now and really ask, you know, do you think this measure is valid in the sense that it captures the underlying quality construct that we think it's trying to capture. And it's interesting listening to the dialogue here. I'm not sure that sort of ad hoc feedback from hospitals is going to get at that, right? We're hearing concerns from the anesthetologists here that maybe this isn't, capturing what it really needs to be capturing. And I just want to read a few things comment because I think these forms are not the most current NQF forms, and they don't say if you're using face validity, you need to quantify them. So those are really new forms that we've been...
Yeah. These are the new forms. These are them.
So maybe you just don't see... You see it when you're filling it out, but it doesn't print out those criteria. Okay. But, do you have any thoughts on that? Because I think we're kind of loosely using the term validity in this committee, and I just...
Yeah. It's an evolving concept because you're right. The attempt is to try and address validity. We try not to be overly prescriptive about what that means because there are many ways to assess validity, certainly face validity, done in an organized, systematic fashion, but construct validity and certain kinds of, test, retest kind of analysis. Assess validity. So, you know, we're looking for something more than, looks good to me. But it's an evolving thing, and you're absolutely right. I think there is a lot of our membership in the audience who really want to see things, a little bit more objective and a little bit more quantified to the degree that that's possible in this world.
And I think another option listed on the NCHF form now is comparing outcomes with other measures. And we're going to be talking about this set of newborn infection measures. And you know, and I think Dr. Proppen made the suggestion maybe they should be arranged against each other and see whether they really truly are capturing similar things, because we're struggling with all of them a little bit because they're so complex.
That's your agenda item for after lunch.
Get there. So Okay. Are we ready to now vote on reliability and validity of this measure? Can everybody push again? Are we missing anybody? Oh, Kim's over there. No, Kim's here.
Ooh.
13 yes, 11 no.
Usability? You want to talk about that, Scott?
In terms of usability, let's see. There was a note in here about consistent improvement in aggregate performance measures, I guess, between quarter two of 2010 and quarter one in 2011. There was some data presented in here. And in terms of feasibility, let's see. In terms of the group, just to go back here, pretty much we were in the moderate to high range in usability and feasibility split between high and moderate. And a note about needing to harmonize with 478.
If I speak to the usability, and since we're talking about public reporting, the issues about public reporting are not using necessarily this measure or even Vaughn. They're using NHSN, which is slightly different and is more specific and a narrower focus. And as these efforts to decrease these events occur, then the numerator becomes more and more important. And even though Group B strep or maybe early onset E. coli may be uncommon, if you're talking about smaller and smaller number of cases, then using the codes, and I accept what you say that you can't differentiate between true healthcare associated and what's reported, that may be more of an issue. And I think pneumatologists and infectious disease people would have more of a concern about this from a public reporting standpoint.
Have you compared the results of these measures to ones that are based in, like, what cultures, you know, where you, because I just wonder how good the coding is, you know, in relation to, like, some sort of, like, firmer evidence on blood cultures.
We haven't done any comparison to any other measures on this particular measure.
I have to reiterate that the number of babies who are less than 1,500 grams who get antibiotics in the first 5 to 7 days for sepsis is a significant number.
And also, and I think maybe for the non-clinical folks to get some perspective on that, I feel like there's a lot of you know, a lot of charting that goes on is probably highly variable. When a baby in the NICU may, you know, have some minor symptoms, be started on antibiotics, new physician comes on, doesn't know the baby that well, say, well, I'll just continue the antibiotics, like, I don't know this baby. So, you know, not that that's necessarily good quality, but, you know, cultures may always be negative. You know, and so there's different measures, like the CDC has different criteria than the Vaughan, and you know, you have diagnosed. So there's some uncertainty about what truly constitutes an infection or not. And I think once it goes to public reporting, everybody's going to be asking, like, well, you know, are these truly infected babies, or, you know, can we train our coders only to be very specific about what they're actually going to abstract, or are we going to train our doctors to only very specifically write down, you know, X, Y, and Z? So I'm just wondering whether some, you know, whether if it's only based on coding, whether there's going to be a lot of gaming there in the system about, you know, the rates are going to look better, but are we truly going to make a difference to the patients? So.
Okay, any other comments?
Degree laceration.
The OB equivalent.
I have to agree with him as well. And if you're basing it on coding, I would be concerned about coding alone, because that's not always been proven the most accurate.
Anyone else?
So can we vote on the, excuse me, on the usability of this measure? High, moderate, low, insufficient? One high, 10 moderate, 13 low. Moving on. To feasibility, is there anything more we need to say about that? Can we vote? Push again just for good measure. Yay, thank you.
One high, 10 moderate, 13 low.
Okay, moving on to the overall suitability for endorsement.
Sorry, quick question. This is harmonized with another measure we did yesterday. Did we approve that one?
Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Okay, so now we're voting again. Can everyone just press one more time? Okay. That's where we are on first go around. Now remember, we've talked about this. We've got multiple similar measures. That's our afternoon agenda item, is we're going to put these side by side and take a look at them. I think there's been an evolution in discussion and thinking and consideration. And this will give you an opportunity to regroup on these measures, okay?
So we're going to take a 15-minute break. Okay, we've got our work cut out for us.
Why are we having this?
Dr. D.
Let's go.
Work with me.
Do I?
We're still having that echo. No?
Okay. All right.
All right. We're moving.
Okay, Donald's working on it. That's good. All right, let's give it a try. So everybody should be off. Operator, is anyone on the phone line?
Yes.
Okay.
Can you turn your speakerphone off?
Yeah. Okay, is that better?
Better?
No. It just started, Donald. Who has the handheld mic? Gene? Is it over there? Is it off? Yeah, with three-part harmony. Are we making any improvement? Okay. All right. Take the opportunity while we can. All right. The next little bit is going to be a little bit of a departure. What we've done is we're going to be looking at a composite measure. And just some history. There is a growing interest in composite measures because they do kind of bring summary information together. Several years ago, NQF had looked at the measure evaluation criteria as applied to composite measures. Now, admittedly, we haven't reviewed that in a couple of years, and there have been a lot of new composites made, so there are some challenges that we have yet to confront. But composite measures are typically measures that are some way combined of individual components to arrive at a single score. So that's what we mean by a composite measure. And one of sort of the underlying principles is that the component measures should either be an endorsed measure or meet the criteria for endorsement. The measure we have in front of us is the measure 1769, an adverse outcome index. In this particular case, there's no indication or desire for the individual components to be endorsed independently. They are components of the overall composite measure. However, we do want to be sure that the components are appropriate, that they are, they contribute to the quality construct, they are appropriately defined and coded or whatever the data collection requirement is, that within the context of the composite, they are usable and feasible. So it requires you to think about it a little bit differently. Then the actual composite measure, the overall, there are some additional criteria to consider because the composite methodology has additional elements to it. So again, even if an individual component is not, super strong on its own as part of a composite, that may be perfectly fine. The other issue is to think about the construct for quality of the entire composite. And is that well understood, and do all the components, are they consistent and contribute to that quality construct? Okay? So that's what we're thinking of when we're looking at the importance to measure and report criteria around composites. Go ahead, Matt. Scientific acceptability. The specifications should be just as good, but you will need all the additional specifications for standardizing scales if necessary, scoring rules, weighting rules, how you handle missing data of some of the components, sampling issues if necessary. So the criteria are not different, but you have to look at different elements when you're looking at a composite measure because it has different characteristics. We're still looking for reliability and validity testing. We're still looking at the resulting score demonstrating meaningful differences. Ideally, we'd like to see some analysis of how the components contribute to the overall score. And so, and also that the scoring and weighting rules are consistent with that conceptual construct. So these are the kinds of elements that are additional evaluation criteria when we're talking about a composite. In terms of, I think usability and feasibility, there's not a whole lot there. The one key element is that the data is collected and maintained such that you can deconstruct and go back to the component measures to figure out what
is that what were the contributions of various components to the ultimate score? Okay? So, somewhat different. This particular measure, I'm going to ask Kathleen, who's the lead, to kind of describe the measure conceptually in general. And then what we're going to want to do is quickly go through each of the components to see how you feel about the contribution of that, or whether there are any issues, thinking about all the usual criteria, but within the context of being a component in a composite. And we'll vote just, you know, take a single vote on each of the component elements to see how everyone feels it is as a component. And then we will wind up by talking about all of the different evaluation criteria for the composite measure, the usual important scientific acceptability, usability, with the additional criteria that the component, the composite evaluation criteria has. So, complicated, we've got a lot of steps to go through. So, with that, I'm going to go.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So, as we sort of go through these, I recognize we're going to look one at a time. Is there the opportunity to say no to a particular component, yet the whole rest of it looks okay? Or where? How does that?
Well, I think that's
show at the outset.
Yeah. Well, I think that's going to become one of your issues, because, in all honesty, if you don't like one of the components and feel that that's the fatal flaw of the measure and it's part of the whole, then it's going to be very hard to justify recommending the whole with a fatal flaw at one of the components. Okay? So I think you do need to think about your evaluation of the components in the context of being a contributor to the overall composite score.
I was unclear, and I think maybe it'd be helpful if at the outset, if this were clear for all of us, whether we're being asked to evaluate only the adverse outcomes index or whether it's all three components. Because in the submission, sometimes I think they assumed we were all three, i.e. the ALO, the weighted one, and the severity index.
I think that hopefully in the introduction that Kathleen's going to do, and then perhaps with some comments from the developers, we can get that context before we launch into further discussions.
Well, actually, I think that's a good question, because in reviewing the material, I did not have a solid answer to that question. So maybe you should mention that right away before I proceed. Are you intending to, is the measure, the AOI, the weighted and the severity index? Is that what we're discussing? It wasn't clear. Yeah, why don't you? That's very helpful to know, because I did not know that and did not glean it from the materials.
And is that an all or none, or is the committee considering each one? Because that's a little different than unraveling the index. It's just saying, you know, the AOI versus the weighted, for example. Can we consider them separately?
I think you can discuss that, sure.
Okay, so the adverse outcome index, it just as a background, was created in the context of the research study and looking at the potential impact of team training in labor and delivery environments and their outcomes. And this was a randomized trial that was done almost 10 years ago. And in the context of this study, there were two consensus groups of physicians and nurses who came up with these 10 indicators. And then later on, the indicators were weighted, from my understanding, through a ACOG Quality Improvement and Patient Safety Committee. So you had your two consensus panels, and then they got weighted. Now, there are three, then, issues. So there's the adverse outcome index, the weighted adverse outcome score, and the severity index, and they all are interrelated. Now, they include these 10 components, in-hospital maternal death and intrapartum neonatal death, with all they all have. I'm not going to read into them all the exclusions and clarifications. Uterine rupture, an unplanned maternal admission to the ICU, birth trauma, and it's noted that it's not the same birth trauma as the ARC measure, although we did not approve that yesterday. And then unanticipated operative procedure, admission to the NICU, of a baby over 2,500 grams, Apgar score less than 7 in 5 minutes, maternal blood transfusion, and a third or fourth degree laceration. And the philosophy behind this is that most of these things are very rare, and so if you combine them together, you could be able to use less of a sample and get an idea of what was going on. Now, the philosophy is that each of these things individually represent a aspect of substandard care, and that was repeated throughout the application. I'm not sure if that is a true statement, if all of these represent substandard care. And some of them actually might represent quality care, so there's some disagreement about that. The developer also mentioned that there were several studies in which this was used. It said three studies totaling about 50,000 births, and then gave a list of references. I was able to pull all those references, and of course there's the original randomized trial of teen training, and then there was a study of the hospital, of Beth Israel Hospital, that did not participate in the teen training but coordinated the teen training study. So that was, at first I thought that was the same data, but it wasn't. So those are separate data. Then there was another study that was done, again, a single hospital looking at the active management of risk at term, with the theory that if you induce a subset of people who are at risk for a potentially adverse outcome, you might be in better shape. And they used multiple things to evaluate their intervention, and adverse outcome index was one of them. Then there was the Yale study by Petker, in which they looked at interventions over time, a comprehensive obstetrical team training program, patient safety program, multiple interventions, fetal monitoring certification, induction at the appropriate time, the addition of a patient safety nurse. I can't remember them all, and in full disclosure, I was the one who recommended they do all that, and I have to say I was part of that. I did not participate in the study, but I was one of the consultants that went there and told them to do all that stuff that they eventually did do. So naturally, I was thrilled when I saw that study and it said that, you know, things were moving in the right direction based on the AOI. Then there were two additional papers published. These papers, their specific intention was to evaluate the AOI, not to evaluate a intervention measuring using the AOI as a unit of measurement. This was one, the one was Benedetti's group at the UW in Seattle. They looked at just the one hospital, and they were going to see if the AOI was handy, could it be used for the entire state. So they spent quite a bit of time just looking at their own hospital's data and going back and forth, looking at reliability and validity, and comparing medical record review versus the algorithms put forth by the National Perinatal Information Center, in my understanding. And so I actually emailed these folks to see what the decision was, because they never said at the end of the article what they had decided to do. And they said that they had decided not to go forward using the AOI as statewide adoption, so that was additional information. Then there was a recent paper published by Hamilton, and they were looking at how does the AOI perform. They used a four-hospital system with about 7,000 births, and they were trying to figure out, does the most common thing that happens really lead the, the trend of the AOI? And their contention was that third and fourth degree lacerations, the Apgar situation, and maternal transfusion were leading indicators, and in fact, the third and fourth degree laceration being the most common might obscure some other things that were going on. And also, other people did find that third and fourth degree lacerations and admission to the NICU were the two most common things. And so they then might obscure other trends and other important things that are going on with the other 8 or 9 indicators. There was also a couple of opinion articles published that had some concerns about use of the AOI. There was not anybody that said, wow, this is a great thing, we should do it, but they were measured in their enthusiasm. Then there was another article that was cited several times, however, I could not get it, and you might be able to comment on that. It was something in Wyoming, and it was cited as on the A1 website. I could not find it, but it was something about the hospitals in Wyoming. I did spend quite a bit of time trying to find it, but I don't know what that was about. So the main thing is that this is the philosophy here is that one or more of these things is an indicator of substandard care, which is that's controversial, and that together they can be handy because they don't require as big as a sample. Now, I understand that the National Perinatal Information Center has been using this with a lot of their member hospitals, and you did mention that several times here. I didn't get, none of that data is published, so, you know, I was unable to, you know, make a big comment on that. So, you might be willing to say something about that. So they include both process and outcome measures as well. So that's, you've asked me to stop there, and then we'll discuss further once we talk about these individual things. So that's the state of the evidence at this point.
Yes. Thanks, Kathleen. That was a great summary. Would you like to clarify now the relationship of the three different options and whether you're putting forth one of them specifically for us to consider?
Hi, I'm Steve Pratt. I'm an obstetric anesthesiologist. I was lead anesthesiologist on the original prospective randomized trial. I'm sort of here for our team, but we have two or three other folks on the phone as well, so they'll be asked to help as we move along. I actually think that all three are important, and here's why. The three different components are, one, the adverse outcome index, and that's the percentage of deliveries that is associated with one or more of the 10 events within the component. So if you have all 10, it still counts as one in the numerator. The next, each one of those adverse events has a weight associated to it, ranging from 5 points for a third or fourth degree laceration up to 750 points for a maternal death. The sum of everything below maternal death is equal, actually, to maternal death, and that was one of the caveats we said in weighting this, is that the worst thing that can happen is to have a mom die, and even if all the rest of it occurs, it couldn't be worse than a mom dying. There are two ways to use those weighted scores. One is to take the sum of all of the points from all of the events that occurred over a period of time and divide it by the number of deliveries. That is the weighted adverse outcome score, and it gives you a sense of how much general bad things are happening on the unit. The second is called the severity index, and you take that same numerator of points, the sum of all of those points from all the events, from all deliveries, and divide by the number of deliveries that had an event. So in other words, the numerator from the AOI. And that speaks to how bad the events are when they occur. And so an example of why this is important is one could get rid of third and fourth degree lacerations by doing cesarean delivery on everybody. One would expect that the adverse outcome index would then go down. But lots of other bad things might happen, and the severity index, therefore, should go up because the adverse events that would occur would exclude that bottom, the lowest scoring event. And so we didn't want to allow there to be policies and protocols that might decrease the rate of events but worsen their severity. So I really think that all three, and we've talked about this at length, that really all three measures should be considered here. And it's a way to measure quality in a more aggregate way.
Can I ask a question about that? I was looking at the Yale study where they just counted the worst thing that could have happened. So people have operationalized this different ways. And what I couldn't understand is, like, let's say I was looking at my own maternal mortality data over the last 10 years trying to figure out how this would relate. So if you have somebody that maybe has four or five of these things, but it's one case, do all of those things, are all those things then added into the, so you could have a couple of bad cases and really all of a sudden have a very bad score then, right? Even if none of those cases are related to in any way fault, like an MVA comes in, well, she's pregnant, she gets a blood transfusion, her baby dies, she goes to the ICU.
Right.
No, she does.
Right.
Oh, man. And then that's a lot of bad stuff happening just for that one patient, and it had nothing to do with your so-called substandard care. That's a very concerning situation.
So again, it's the reason to have both of the, all three of these. So you're right, the weighted scores would be moved quite heavily with a couple of those types of cases versus now the adverse outcome index, in fact, wouldn't, because that would count as one or two cases, right? One MVA would be one case. And so it's a way to, in fact, deal with all of those issues. The adverse outcome index wouldn't change with that bad case. The other part of this is, as you've already pointed out, many of these bad events are, in fact, probably not preventable. And we know that. We accept that. That's true of most adverse events in medicine. And if we look at them, preventability is probably on the order of 50% for most of these terrible adverse events. We don't have a great way to try to identify those that are preventable, but we understand that if we can work out that 50% that is, we can still have significant movement. And the Yale study showed on an order from the beginning of their study to the end, the 25% or better improvements. We showed similar results, and that's worth something.
Can you explain how the weighting was done? What, you know, was it? You know, who decided what weights per event and how is it done?
Yeah, Susan, are you on the phone? Is there a way to figure out if we have callers?
Sorry, I'm on mute. Susan Mann, I'm also an obstetrician gynecologist at the Charles Davis Medical Center, one of the developers of this, and the original trial. We asked the American College of OBGYN patient safety, or quality improvement patient safety committee, and I believe it was a consensus process. I don't sit on that committee, so I wasn't privy to the results of their voting and the process they did, but I know it was also a consensus panel.
And as I said earlier, the only rule we gave them is that the sum of the first nine events could not be more than maternal death. After that, they came up with the specific numbers.
Okay, and then in your consensus panel, that you had your two consensus conferences, that's how you came up with the 10. Were there, it doesn't mention in all the articles, at least maybe I skipped it, how many did you start with, and then what did you weed out to get to that 10?
Yes, so we actually published that process a few years ago.
Yeah, got them all right here.
We started with more than 50. And again, Susan, speak up because you were the lead author on this. But we started with more than 50. We used six fairly specific criteria as we went through each one of these. Many of them overlapped. The goal was, what we ultimately wanted were events that we thought, one, were likely to be preventable. To some extent, we were looking at things that were likely to be preventable by broader aspects of care than a single policy, so things that would change the overall quality of care. And so we were looking specifically at teamwork. But overall, other protocols and broad guidelines have now been demonstrated to be effective, as you mentioned, the study at Penn, looking at management of risk in late gestation. But we were, at the time, looking largely for things that
for
might
teamwork, be... Right. For teamwork, right. They were developed to set up teamwork.
That was originally the development.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And it also included 10 process measures?
Yeah, those have not been included here, though. These are just the 10 outcomes.
Does anybody else have any questions about the actual measure?
If you'd like, I can on the development, you commented a couple that some of these might be actually measures of good care, and the two that sort of jump out are maternal transfusion and admission to the intensive care unit. Mm-hmm. We would never want to say, oh, it's a bad idea to transfuse a mom with a, you know, hematocrit of 12, right? And we understood that as we developed it. The issue there is that many of the events on labor and delivery that lead to either one of those are associated with bad care. And I'll use the ICU admission for the leading causes of maternal ICU admission as you look from study to study to study, a maternal hemorrhage, eclampsia, preeclampsia. Those tend to be the leading causes. The literature is very clear that we don't manage any of those things very well, both in looking at what we know about actual care, but also when we look at the simulation data. These are things that none of us do very well, or that are associated with a relatively high rate of inadequate or substandard care. Rather than trying to have to go through each one of these various reasons for which a mom might get admitted to the intensive care and measure each one of those, which would have become much more difficult, we went with the concept that if these high-risk deliveries are managed effectively, the likelihood that mom will end up in the intensive care unit goes down. And so this was a way to sort of grab all of that substandard care in these high-risk deliveries and identify when or they've gone badly and mom has ended up in the intensive care unit. Similar thinking went into the transfusion conversation and management of induction, for instance, would be a risk factor there potentially, and that was the thinking behind those two in particular.
Okay, well, I did look at the references you provided as far as ICU admissions, and number one was hypertensive disease, then hemorrhage, then septic abortion, and not obstetric sepsis. And so those, again, in my opinion, are not all amenable to care. I mean, stuff happens, you know. So if those are the leading causes of admission to the ICU for a mother, and that is an indicator, then that would be something controversial, I guess. And then overall philosophy is that if you look at some of these things, there can be sort of gaming of the system if you were sophisticated enough to say, well, hey, maybe I'll just bring the people down to my L&D unit rather than admitting them to the ICU because I'll get a better score. Or, she's on the borderline. Let's not transfuse her because, I mean, I don't know if that would really happen, but it does seem to kind of push people towards doing things that might not be in the best interest of mothers and babies. Also, with the avoidance of the third and fourth degree laceration, maybe you're going to, have more cesareans. This is just a philosophical thing when you look at the whole thing as a composite. So I wanted to bring that up as well.
That is fair. And, we worked on this very hard thinking about we would, God forbid we would ever try to dissuade people from taking very sick moms and putting them in the intensive care unit, right?
I know.
We had such a hard time believing that anyone would actually do that. And you speak to, yes, bad things happen with severe preeclampsia and the hypertensive disorders. On the other hand, up to 80% of moms with severe preeclampsia do not have their blood pressure managed well. And, I think about my own specialty as an anesthesiologist. This is something in which we are absolute experts. And my guess is that many of my colleagues around the country are not as involved in the management of those patients as we might be. Again, now speaking to the teamwork discussion. Is it possible that some, moms are running around with an inadequate of 18 and feeling a little bit, fatigued and they didn't get transfused because of the adverse outcome index? Would that be possible? I suppose it would. But I would certainly hope that there would not be a big...
I'm not saying that's legitimate. I'm just throwing it out there.
No,
something that's in the literature, to bring that up in full, fair discussion here. Others have mentioned that in the literature.
Similarly, the NICU admissions, oh my God, that echoes. Steve, do you want to talk about the NICU admissions issue?
This is a biggie. In some places, it is almost a primary driver for their adverse outcome index. And, Janet can probably speak to this better than I. When we look at the data for some of these hospitals, there are some folks who have adverse outcome index rates of 20-25%. Now, remember, we almost entirely driven by NICU admissions. Now, remember, this is at term. This is and greater than 2,500 grams. So these are good-sized term babies, and they have to be there for more than 24 hours. So this isn't they just went and got some blood cultures for rule-out sepsis. These are generally real admissions at term. And there's such huge variation in that But it's one of the, it's actually, that's the one that I think is going to be also difficult to deal with. I frankly think that those hospitals should have to own up to the fact that they're sending 25% of their babies to the NICU.
Don't you think that there could be some financial incentives
for
that?
Yeah,
I do.
I absolutely do.
So send somebody to the NICU.
I think it's a good thing to put that in the numerator, though, that these folks are making those decisions out of financial reasons.
It's possible. I don't know. I'm just saying that.
I had the privilege of training at the BI, so I know the system very well. But other hospitals are just they're structured differently. So in some hospitals, babies will be sent to the level 2 unit to receive 2 days of antibiotics, and in other places they'll just have a workup. And they can go to the mother's room. And so I wonder whether some of your, whether some of your high rates actually derive from these just different structural setups. You could argue that, well, maybe they should change the setup, but I think that I wonder whether those are true differences in neonatal outcomes or just the way the hospital is structured.
I just wanted to introduce my...
So maybe we should save the discussion for the individual components as we go through the measure. Lee?
In your submission, you mentioned that the, and I'm not quite clear what the it is, I think it's probably all three measures, are currently being used in QI collaboratives both in the state of Maryland and in the Premier system. Now, the Premier system we're all pretty familiar with, I think, and Maryland's one of the fairly progressive states in improving maternal and child health quality. Are they using them in the context of reinforcing the team concept?
Oh, thank you, Steve. I just want to introduce myself. I'm Janet Murray, president of the National Perinatal Information Center. The Maryland Patient Safety Program used it in the context of team steps, IHI bundles, and ICHD. So this was, they did some collection around that, those components, as well as some process. And then they used the AOI as well. That whole program has just finished, and they're in the process of publishing. So they're working on some articles on that, and they found really nice improvement for many of the hospitals. The hospitals that didn't improve seem to have some issues around the team, the leadership of the team, and things like that, where they really couldn't, really fully engage the team concept. The Premier is a subset of their hospitals that are part of their excess risk program. They have a patient safety program that they've been involved with for about 2 or 3 years, and they too are beginning to publish. They've just moved over to an AHRQ grant to do some research with a comparison group of hospitals that are not doing the interventions that they're doing. So,
Jennifer?
So my concern with this measure in general, and I want to give you some examples and just see what you say, is the risk adjustment piece. So, for example, if the case, if everybody had the same mix of patients at all these hospitals, that would make sense to me that this would be a good measure. But given that we have trauma centers, and given that especially now there's a movement towards Acrita centers, right, where these women are really, we know that they're a higher risk, some are going to die, they better get transfusions, they should be in the ICUs. And so these patients are not equally distributed across America. I can understand using the AOI to look at your own hospital year after year after year and see how you're doing, because your case mix doesn't change that much from year to year. I have grave concerns about comparing hospitals using this with no risk adjustment. Can you speak to that a little bit?
I'll let Janet speak to that, because we've been able to do this, not risk adjusting at the individual patient level, but at the type of institutional level a little bit and comparing similar institutions.
Yeah, thank you. One of the things that we looked at when we looked at the Maryland patient safety data as well as the Premier data is to divide the hospitals by level of care, 1, 2, and 3, and then also by academic, non-academic. So that was, it's not really a risk adjusting. We've talked about really risk adjusting at the patient level, and I think that's the direction we would like to go in. But in terms of just looking at differences in types of hospitals, we can subset the data and look at the metrics that way.
So that makes sense to me to some degree to stratify and look at it within those strata, but also shared care hospitals are not alike. right? A tertiary care hospital in the suburbs is different than the inner city, is different than the two or three Accreta centers around the country. So I just caution that we may be under risk adjusting or under stratifying, because you really need to know a lot about those individual hospitals in a community before you can say one is worse than the other.
Nancy?
I have a question, really, which gets to one of our key criteria, which is the public reporting aspect of this thing. You know, indices that are developed for use in research and are composite measures are usually fairly complicated for even the most sophisticated among us to interpret because of the complexity of the individual elements that go into a composite. And that was my reaction to this whole thing, is if we throw these out to the public, and I think, you know, Jennifer has brought up some of the issues with it as a public reporting measure, but I have great difficulty with understanding how, at the public level, this could really be well understood in the context of the complexity of not only patient mix, but provider mix. You know, a rural hospital or a frontier hospital in the middle of Oregon, which has 49 babies a year, if they have one maternal death and it gets reported, which may be a totally preventable or a non-preventable maternal death, an MVA off the highway, a bad preeclamptic who is fulminates and comes in and it is a tragedy. I'm really struggling with the public reportability aspect of it and the understandability from a public perspective of this complex of a measure. So if you could just speak to that a little bit, why you think the public would be able to resonate with this measure and really understand it substantively rather than us approaching it from the individual measure standpoint.
For me, and now Susan, I'll let you go, and actually I think Michelle will probably comment. My response to that is I think it's going to be hard to figure out what the public was going to be able to understand. I'm not sure that they can necessarily understand even the component measures within the context of the complexity of healthcare. I think having some idea of stratification, and we've done that, would help, number one. Number two, that single maternal death is not going to change their complication rate very much. It's going to change the severity score a lot. But their complication rate is not going to change any more than the third or fourth degree laceration that they had last week as well. And then finally, while we get very concerned about those sorts of things, the likelihood that there's going to be a maternal death in a place who's delivering, you know, if the maternal mortality rate is, you know, 0.8 per 10,000, the likelihood that if they're doing 200 deliveries a year, that's 50 years worth of deliveries. And so the likelihood that we're going to run into that particular problem very much, I think, is quite small. Yes, we should look at the multiple standard deviations out from in the bell-shaped curve of these events, but you're probably now talking, you know, in that particular example, you know, 4, 5, 6 standard deviations out in terms of that rate. So, yeah, the question is, do you want this to be something that works very well in the middle and a couple standard deviations out, or does it need to work all the way out to the very end of those statistics?
I'm sorry.
I don't know if I can really add too much to that, except that I appreciate that concern, and I think that, I think there are a lot of measures out there that the public has difficulty understanding, and so, but I think part of the public is, our payers and other quality groups that are doing assessments and reviews and things like that. So I think if it's a measure that maybe needs a little bit, or measures that need a little bit more explanation, I think you can do it in language that makes it clear for these three. But will everybody understand it? Will the whole general public understand it? Probably not.
I guess I would like to go back to Kathleen's point about the issue that we could bypass a lot of these parts of the composite by doing cesareans. And I'm going to go through the list. Intrapartum fetal death, uterine rupture, birth trauma, unanticipated surgery, Apgar less than 7, and third and fourth degree lacerations. That's 6 out of your 10 composites. And there really aren't any balancing things to look at the maternal morbidity that we're seeing from all the excess cesareans that we're doing. A lot of us, I think, understand that some of the complications we're seeing in obstetrics are higher in the last 20 years because of our interventional attitudes. And I know there are folks around the table that really support natural childbirth, so I guess I would like to bring that up to kind of think about what the individual things in the composite are, and are they really balanced as far as what our public health goals are for women's health. So I'd just like to hear some comments.
Sue, do you want to take some of that?
That's why we have a, echo is that. That's why we have the weighting is to look at that. And furthermore, the experience at our own institution collecting this data, actually our cesarean section rate has decreased in the last several years. So I think that it's not necessarily people don't make an individual decision to do a cesarean section based on their rate of on the adverse outcome index score. It's a very complex decision on why you do a cesarean section. So I am a proponent of natural childbirth as well and vaginal deliveries, and I don't think that these aren't necessarily in concert with one another. I still think it's information that's been useful for hospitals. We've certainly seen hospitals drill down and do quality improvement projects such as hemorrhage protocols, shoulder dystocia drills, based on their experience with the staff.
Just one thing to clarify as well. I thought we had made the language clear that the neonatal death is actually in-hospital neonatal death, not intrapartum. And if it says that, I'm sorry. I thought we had changed that. It is not just intrapartum. It is during the delivery hospitalization. And so that changes that outcome significantly. Because babies can die after cesarean delivery or due to events related to cesarean delivery. But obviously, if they have an elective cesarean delivery, they cannot die of an intrapartum death. So that one would be changed at least a little bit.
Thank you, Chuck.
Can I offer one additional comment?
Yes.
I think the unit should step in the unit. That was just a bit of the medical center, and we're related to the team and she's and the others. The composite measure would allow for some capture of kind of unintended patterns for the increases that you would be through the admission rates, moving to the gestational age. The rates of admission are higher for C-sections and progression for circulatory increase in unintended C-sections that should capture the ready conditions.
The other part of this is, I think we're all in favor of having normal vaginal deliveries, and as an anesthesiologist, not willing to use the word natural childbirth, but exactly. although my wife had both of her babies with no medications, thank you very much. But on the other hand, if we can demonstrate that the cesareans that we're doing are in fact changing adverse events, if the complication rates are changing because of the cesarean deliveries, or at least in association with those, then those are the ones we want to be doing. And I'm not convinced that doing a cesarean delivery to save a third or fourth degree laceration is necessarily the right thing to do. But if one is doing the C-sections and it's improving the rest of these scores, those are the ones we want to do. That is the kind of medicine, at least I think, that we likely want to do. And as Susan said, our cesarean section that rate went down at the same time that our adverse event rate went down, so, and our severity index went down. So it all moved in a good direction.
And are you attributing that to this program implementation in particular, or were other things going on at the time?
we really believe that this was, that the teamwork was a big chunk of this. Now, as Susan alluded, the teamwork actually ended up leading to many, many, many other changes. As you sit there and work as a team, you realize all the other issues that come up on the unit. And so the development of communication protocols with the attending anesthesiologist came out of this. So if there is a vacuum delivery now on our unit, I get called. So that if there's a stat section for that failed vacuum, I'm already in the operating room. 90% of the time or more, the vacuum works and I go back to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. But those are all things that are not specific to teamwork, but came out of all of this. Hemorrhage protocols, shoulder dissociative protocols, then drills to help practice all of these things grew out of that. So I won't say just the team steps-based teamwork training did it, but...
I think there's a difference between, if we measure healthcare and we put a lot of sunshine on it, you have impetus to get better and things are going to get better. But I think the NQF has a purview to hold measures to a higher standard, which is public reporting of intra-hospital comparisons. And that's a different, potentially a different kind of measure. Even if this is very good at what you're talking about quality improvement, it doesn't necessarily mean it's ready for the big stage of we're going to identify hospital X as being a not so good hospital, and Aetna won't cover it, and Medicaid won't favor it, and they have big, big implications. And so that quality improvement work and something that's useful in an individual hospital quality improvement work is not the same, I think, as what we need to hold a measure to.
Chuck, please go ahead.
Well, I can think of a couple of positive things to say about this. I agree with a lot of the comments about that as a public reporting measure of hospital quality, it sort of has a lot of it has a lack of transparency, and part of that I think is because, I think you're overdoing the link. I mean, we all want to have our indexes relate strongly to a single construct, and your construct that you've named is quality care. But I think this thing can have value without going that far, and it's sort of as an intermediate thing. What's striking me about this is that it solves some problems that I've been thinking about for the last 2 days. We have problems with sort of defining what are good validation strategies for a lot of the measures that we've been talking about, the process measures we've been talking about today. We have also been talking about the fact that a lot of outcomes we'd like to prevent happen very rarely and don't aggregate well to individual hospitals and things like that. And so this is a sort of, I think of this as more of a utility measure, where it's not necessarily for public reporting at all. And it's not necessarily labeled as a quality of care thing. The construct it measures is adversity, and that it can be used exactly in the way that it's been used in the literature described, to assess the generalized impacts of multifaceted, things. Everything from, improving teamwork in hospitals and communication in hospitals to, what's the impact of delayed prenatal care or low-quality prenatal care, or, a mom moving from one state to another in the middle of her pregnancy. I mean, there's a lot of issues like that. And so something like this could become a good sort of standard, and I don't know if that means we would endorse it, but it could become a good standard for, use this to validate generalized measures to prove a broad impact across a lot of outcomes. And let me just close with another example. I'm sure a lot of you saw the same article I did a year or two ago. I think it was called an index of near-miss mortality or something like that, right, where a whole bunch of different adverse events were added together, and the scale was, or the weights were basically, as far as I remember, how likely each event was likely to result in mortality. I think it was all maternal mortality. So a laceration would have, a very low weight because it's very unlikely by itself to lead to it, right? And other things. And there were a lot of things in the near miss that aren't in here. What's nice about this is that it's kind of randomly poking at different parts of the system. And so it would be a good first pass way to look at systemic improvements. And it would be a good sort of generalized way to, as a first pass for validations, maybe. Those are comments I have. I think this thing could have a place in the firmament of measures, but maybe not. It doesn't have that linkage to direct patient quality improvement that we've been using as a standard for the last 2 days.
just to clarify, public reporting is one type of accountability, and while that may not be the only, it's certainly something of an area we see a lot of, but other accountabilities around the payment accreditation, kind of things are also included. So it isn't absolutely public reporting, but that accountability realm.
So when you say that, I just want to clarify, because I think this is really important. I totally agree with Jennifer's point. And if you move into the payment realm, I think you're in the realm of comparing hospitals in this case. And so that's really what we're asking, even if you don't use the word public reporting. You're saying, should this be used to compare and either, publicly report or quantitatively reward or penalize hospitals using this measure? Would that be fair? So it has to meet that standard.
Yeah, and I would say as the payer in the room, or one of the payers in the room, that from an absolute count perspective, here are the number of complications per delivery. You know, it's interesting. It says something. I think when you put the weighted averages on it, you really have to dive into whether that's the right weighting, and then the risk adjustment piece is huge because you can't compare hospitals. I mean, it's a non-starter in a discussion about hospitals until you can risk adjust it.
Kathleen, did you?
I just wanted to make a comment that, to respond to what you said about it as a measure of adversity, but the one thing I think that can't be overlooked is that there's an underlying assumption that this adversity is related to substandard care, and that is not the case in each one of these things. If that were the case, if there was somehow, because I really like this concept, I'm not opposed at all, I like the whole thing. It's just that if there's some way to do a preventable versus non-preventable for each one of these 10 things, and I know there's not, it would be great. But there isn't a way, and the way this is put together is you're making an assumption that there is a direct link between one of these 10 things and substandard care, and it's repeated throughout all the things that you've submitted, and I don't think that that is true, So that's the problem I have with that. The adversity is not all related to substandard care.
Kathy, I'm just going to mention one of those examples, I think, is the incidence of episiotomy versus tear. And so episiotomy being the direct clinical intervention we're wanting to avoid versus third and fourth degree laceration. If you have a shoulder dysplasia, you need to get the kid out. That's not a clinical mistake, whereas episiotomy ought to be used rarely and with caution. So how did you choose third and fourth degree lax? And some of these things, what were your considerations in thinking towards
that? I think we need to phrase the specific questions for later. Two of the three versions are so influenced by the weighting process. I wanted to ask Sean Kerrigan, if you could comment on that, about how that worked.
I was not present for the waiting because that happened before my time, but my understanding was that it was how measures were developed in those days. A bunch of guys around a table and they discussed.
Guys, literally.
I think at that time, it wasn't that long ago, but they discussed it and deliberated over like half of a committee meeting about the weighting, and I don't know that they used they didn't use numbers to come up with those weighted scores.
Okay, thank you. That was helpful. So I think we're going to now ask our lead discussants to very briefly present each of the components. Can we try to switch to 5 minutes for presentation and quick discussion and a vote? And my understanding is that it would be possible to vote no on some subset and then revisit this at the end by looking at the whole and say, is it a deal breaker? So it's not as if we vote no, we stop. Yeah, so we'll go through them all and then we'll discuss, come back again to the total.
So the first one is Bill Callahan for in-hospital maternal deaths.
Hi, I think this will be brief. A lot of what has been discussed already pertains particularly to this particular measure. So the measure is all pregnant women who die during the hospital. They come in for delivery, and the denominator is all pregnant women who delivered during whatever time you're measuring this in. As somebody who has spent the last 10 years writing and talking around the country about pregnancy-related mortality and severe morbidity, and this is something that's near and dear to my heart, I view maternal deaths as a true sentinel event that demands that the reasons for death, the factors associated with death, be identified, reviewed, and that that information be used to take action for preventability. That being said, I share the same issue that has been brought up over and over and over again in terms of how that relates to accountability. We do surveillance of maternal mortality in the Division of Reproductive Health. It's a little bit different from the National Center for Health Statistics. We identify about 600 deaths per year. Probably about 400 of them are during the delivery hospitalization. So these are extraordinarily rare. And that being said, we think that at the same time, the fact that that one woman died likely resulted from processes and system problems that occur over and over and over and over again all over the place, and in fact don't result in death, perhaps because of the sheer tenacity of young women who can survive a lot. But that doesn't mean that those processes shouldn't be addressed. So our take on, my take, I guess, is personal on maternal deaths. These should be reviewed in aggregate, perhaps at the facility, but even better at states where these systematic errors, if there are systematic errors, and again, we think that about 50% are preventable by changes in healthcare behavior or system problems, and that those the factors associated with them, once they're identified, those are shotgunned out to everybody. You don't assume that it's that hospital that made the mistake and only happened there. It happens everywhere all the time. And the system needs to be improved over and over and over again everywhere. So from that standpoint, these are incredibly important events to review, but I don't know that we should be, as everybody else, as many people have said, being used for accountability and public reporting. I have some real problems with that being the review of maternal deaths being used in that way. I think they should be reviewed, but not just counted and ticked off.
Thank you.
Counting, ticking them off isn't going to the information gets lost. There's nothing that can be learned from it, except perhaps maybe in the one instance. That it occurred. Perhaps a public health perspective as opposed to an individual.
So a quick comment, please, from the developer perspective, and then we'll hear from others.
I would just say that these are not, we in no way would suggest that these are mutually exclusive. We are no way suggesting that this is the only way that maternal deaths should be reviewed. And I agree with you that they are such high sentinel events, absolutely everyone needs to be reviewed. That doesn't mean that they couldn't be also part of a numerator process for adverse events. And so that would be my only comment back to you, is that our intent was never to try to undermine the case review for this. And so.
Thank you. Comments from other members of the committee on maternal mortality as a component? Okay. Wow. We make our 5 minutes almost. So let's have a vote then about this particular component.